disgrace, and it is a public scandal.
Chris Marks.
Morris.
We're hearing quite a lot of people being forced to pump themselves up. Do you think this is a good idea?
No.
Why not?
Too much pressure.
Too much pressure can inflate the head?
Oh, yes. Most decidedly.
And an inflated head, of course, can lead to people having too high an opinion of themselves.
Yeah.
So, how high should one's opinion of oneself be allowed to rise? Above ground level.
Above ground level? About 18 inches, perhaps.
No more?
Perhaps less.
And that, I suppose, would be determined by the degree of inflation of the ego.
Oh, yes.
To what pressure do you think the ego should be inflated, then?
About 2-3 pounds square inch.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 19th of July, 2024, streaming live from Eastone Studios in Bristol, which, with London's Inner Temple as one of several Templar ports, Bristol that is, not these studios, in the Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton in Warwickshire, radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, thanks to all of those, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please install Aurora if you can find out where it is and what it is. If you don't know, just go to our show page and there's a link to Aurora there. And you can actually just disable Google Play and just download everything from the Aurora store, which has the unedited apps. So, for example, Telegram, those nasty Google people at the Play Store said, oh, you can only put Telegram on here if we can have our little back doors and strange little things going on in it. And so Telegram had to do that in order for people to be able to download. But you can get the original from Telegram from the Aurora Store. So always try and recommend that. I'm Tony Gosling. And thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda, the psyops boring us to tears, also with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to every crisis, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, farming, cost of living, climate, there's a new one every couple of months, isn't there? Twisted Armageddonist and accelerationist policies. Jules Evans' article, very good on that. Amphetamine philosophy and the death trip about accelerationism. Craftily crafted to make every crisis worse. Aren't they doing well at it? And the politicians have nothing to say. Wife-murdering pantheist WEF King Tampon Charlie was in the House of Commons this week giving his big speech and waging war on the British people as well as China, Russia and the BRICS, with Libya regime change, maniac sidekick Diddy David Cameron now history. Instead, we've got that recycled Ed Miliband, the guy we kicked out. He's been brought in. He's managed to stay on, cling on as an MP, and now he's in charge of offshore wind farms for the king, because the king owns all of the seabed and every offshore wind farm is money for King Charles. That's why he loves Ed Miliband. Oh, no, that's right, because he's saving the planet, isn't he, along with people like David Attenborough. Anyway, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Industrial Revolution, the Fourth Reich Matrix, it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and Deputy Leader of the Workers' Party, as well as Vice Chair of ASLEF, but he's here with the Workers' Party hat on today, Andy Hudd. This week, obviously, we'll be looking at the Trump assassination attempt. Absolutely shocking. On Saturday night, just as we were all going to sleep, suddenly, ping, somebody said, it looks like someone's just tried to kill him. But we'll be looking at that in depth after the break. Before that, the King's speech, the programme, but also looking at a couple of stories here, which are the disturbances in Leeds that we saw last night, as well as this massive cyber attack. What on earth is going on? It looks like Microsoft Updates has just taken out airlines, railway systems, hospitals. There's a whole list of things which are not working today because of some sort of massive, marvellous, massive security update. The company run by apparently a Russian American who's moved to America. That's his little firm. So maybe the Russians are really behind it after all. Anyway, look, we'll start with Andy. We've just had this general election. What did you? Were you out there campaigning for the Workers' Party?
Yeah, I was actually. I was out in Doncaster Central with a very good friend of mine, Tosh McDonald, and out knocking doors there and delivering leaflets. Also popped over to Rotherham and then finally Rochdale. So with my days off.
So that Rochdale is George Galloway's.
That's right.
But he didn't win, did he? You know, you see, he won the by-election, but when it actually came to the general election, the locals weren't supporting him.
No, that's right. Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, of course. The media blackout nationally was a bit strange, but we dealt with it. But we also, oddly, had Hope Not Hate delivering leaflets around the doorstep in Rochdale against George, so that didn't help either.
So what were they saying?
Some bland message about don't let divisive Galloway back in. And
so what were they accusing Galloway of, though?
I think it was in division. I can't remember the words on the leaflet. It was kind of, it's strange for a charity to be delivering leaflets on behalf, against.
Well, charities aren't allowed to campaign politically, actually. So I don't know if they are actually a charity. Do you want to say something about Hope Not Hate, Martin? They've been around for a while, haven't they? And they were, I think, a sort of offshoot of groups like the Anti-Nazi League.
Well, I think they were more respectable than the Anti-Nazi League in terms of their orientation. They've become a kind of... They suggest themselves as, being anti-fascists, but they've also been very... they're almost like, as you say, but what's an anti-fascist group doing handing out leaflets against George Galloway? You know, it's just not appropriate, is it? I mean, it's just, that tends to suggest a bit like the Quilliam Foundation. Do you ever come across them? They were supposedly moderate Muslims and were, in fact, a front organisation for the intelligence services. And I'm afraid Hope Not Hate, I've got my suspicions that they are of a similar ilk.
So they're campaigning against George, but I'm trying to get down to the nitty gritty of it. What were they accusing him of?
It was about George sowing divisions in the community. I'll try and get a copy of the leaflet up, but also maybe probably need to be careful because I think we might be doing there might be some illegal going on in the background.
Ah, right. Okay. Well, anyway, I mean, there's some sort of attempt specifically to target Rochdale and undermine George specifically. But I mean, the party didn't do very well. I think you fielded how many? I think is it 150 candidates around the country?
Yeah, it's 154. But actually, I mean,
you should get at least one or two, surely.
Yeah. Well, this is it. We were up against it, but we did do we fielded. Well, we got about 210,000 votes. So in about four areas, we came very close, give Jess Phillips a scare and, in a few other places, I think Luton as well. We were looking at the start of the campaign is to basically a good place to be was to keep George's seat in Rochdale and then get over 150,000 votes.
So look, on a tactical point of view, surely you should have been focusing your attention more on a smaller number. 150 is a massively ambitious project and must have been lots of deposits lost.
Yeah, there was, and most of those who became candidates done that with their own money. Oh. But that, to us, that shows strength of feeling for and belief in the Workers' Party.
But it's a strategic error, tactical error, surely, to try to get 150 seats and then actually end up with none, when at least you have one to start with.
Yeah, well, we made sure we focused on Rochdale as a primary, and there are three other seats which we kind of focused on where we had pretty good chances. But the reason why we had to field so many candidates is to get above the 150,000 threshold, because then obviously state funding becomes a thing.
So how does that work?
I'm not entirely sure. The experts elsewhere will know that. But if you get over 150,000 votes, you start getting funding from government then to organise. But you need an MP, so we missed on that one.
Oh, it's annoying, isn't it? Martin, it really seems as if the Workers' Party has been... I know you're a Labour Party member, so you'll probably be rubbing your hands with glee.
No. No, I mean, I think what's happened is the Workers' Party weren't the only left force in the election. I mean, you had the independents that were standing against Labour candidates and Labour sitting Labour MPs. And so we could put all of the votes of the Workers' Party, those independents, some, you know, left dissidents, if you like, and it's quite a substantial movement, isn't it? But it's not just the Workers' Party. They're part of a wider, a wider movement of people that aren't happy with the way the status quo functions. And I think that's a pretty clear outcome of the election, even though, because of the setup, it leads to a Labour majority of 170-something, which is just ridiculous if you think about it. No other country in Europe works like that. It means that they can now do what they want, even though they haven't really got a mandate, which is no good.
No, they haven't. And they keep talking about having a mandate too. And in fact, Starmer, almost every speech he makes, says he's got a mandate, Andy.
Yeah, well, I mean,
contradiction is that he's got two-thirds of the MP on about a third of the vote.
Yeah, well, that's the mad thing about it. And I think people like us will still be talking about that particular election, I think, for decades to come, because it's really bizarre. You know, the Labour Party got, under Starmer, less votes than Jeremy Corbyn did in 2017 and 19, even though they have a higher proportion. Anyway, it's all a bit weird. As soon as the result came through, I was thinking, well, actually, this is a government made on sand. You know, it can easily shift. I mean, they really...
Well, no, because they've got two-thirds of the MPs. There's no one's going to shift them. It's a little bit like the Tories were back in 2019. Massive majority, we can do what we want. Not that they actually did much with it.
I think it's about, if you think about the discontent, and if you, when you go around the doors, and well, just living a life, being a human being, in the world will tell you that the UK is disenfranchised from the political system and the process, and they don't recognise their politicians. And, that showed, of course, in the lack of turnout, there is a disquiet. There's an uneasiness, and I think, Labour have got to do something special to try and put that away.
Well, I think the problem is that if you look at the economic policy they're going to pursue, I was reading a very depressing article about how Rachel Reeves has been going around the City of London, and what they're going to do is all the infrastructure that they're going to invest in, they're not going to use public money, they're going to use private money in public-private partnerships. Now, everybody, the dogs in the street, know that public-private partnerships are a rubbish way to fund anything.
The dogs know.
Well,
well, they are. You're upset. Yes, you're
I mean,
right.
It's just
everybody
a stupid
knows,
way to do it. You know,
it
costs far more to do it that way than to just spend the money.
And often you don't actually end up with ownership of it.
That's right. It ends up in the hands of private equity companies who then charge you a fortune for accessing your own infrastructure. And I think that's a pretty clear indication of the direction of travel that they're in. Well, and that's, that is not left wing in any way, shape or form. It's just basically... it's basically, finance capital is just being given its head there. And that's exactly what they're going to do, isn't it?
Particularly with the lack of the share of the vote, but the amount of MPs, many members of the public must be looking at the political system and saying, what's the point?
Well, that's true, Tony, but at the same time, what may happen is they're going to come a cropper on things like the international situation. I mean, they can't discuss things like the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, even though that really does make a big difference to the economy.
Well, they're talking
Europe.
About Gaza, aren't they?
Well, that's another crowd. Are we going to go to war with Lebanon? Because we're already at war with Yemen. And I think even those Labour MPs that have been elected aren't necessarily going to swallow that. You know, they may say, hang on a minute, this is a bridge too far. And then Starmer may find himself without a majority over something like that quite easily.
So, anyway, what do you make of it? Is there any point in getting... I mean, you must be pretty disillusioned by the fact that there wasn't a singles... I mean, because Farage and Reform did rather better, didn't they? They managed to get, four MPs, I think? It may just be to do with the funding. It may be to do with the press coverage. How come the Workers' Party didn't get the MPs and Reform did?
Well, it's, you make the contrast there. I mean, we had George Galloway as the MP in Rochdale, and we had zero airtime. We had one broadcast. Reform, zero MPs, plenty of airtime. And I think,
Well, George did get a bit of airtime when he started saying that, oh, Starmer's going to start a war within 6 months. There was loads of coverage, and it might just simply be that Farage has got the right lines that the media are picking up on, and George isn't.
George not having the right lines. We all know George. If it needs to be said, he's not scared of saying it, so I don't think that's the case.
What do you make of that claim, though, about Starmer and the war? That's a little bit, you know, a lot of people looking at that scratching theirs, really.
I don't... What was said?
George Galloway said was that if Starmer is elected, that we'll be at war within 6 months.
Oh, right, well, yeah. Well, it's clearly happening. You know, if you look at what's going on with the NATO meeting and what they call it, the
G7?
No. It was the new it's the political, the European political.
Ah, right. Yes. Yeah. In Blenheim Palace.
That's right.
Hitler's favourite. That's where he wanted to live once he'd taken over Britain. He announced that in 1940. When I take over Britain, I will live in Blenheim Palace.
Because there will be this. You know, when we looked at the previous Labour government under Blair, there is this kind of thing that goes on in Labour heads in that they think, well, we've got to be the grown-up, we've got to be statesmanlike. And that kind of, you know, that equates to being strong on defence and military and all these other things, which actually don't make a lot of sense when you especially look at Ukraine and a war with Russia.
You know, it reminds me all, Martin, of the Iraq war and the weapons of mass destruction. We're getting all this kind of hate against Putin. Actually, if you listen to what he's saying, most of it makes a lot more sense than many of our politicians seem to make. But the whole point seems to be to, basically to demonise the Russians and there's a certain unhinged attitude here. I mean, they've had, for example, Gaddafi's got to go. Gaddafi's got to go, repeated time and time again. We had Assad has got to go. And now they're saying Putin's got to go, but they haven't really thought about the fact that he can't go. And if you try and make him go, he's going to nuke you.
Obviously the political class in the West have got themselves into a complete corner where, if Putin is Hitler, they've got to get rid of him, but they can't, and they're losing the war. And the war is being lost as we speak. And the danger is, as we said last week, Starmer at the NATO meeting said, as far as he's concerned, it was okay for Storm Shadow missiles to be used to fire into Russia proper. And then the Minister of Defence, as you said, then came out in the Daily Telegraph saying, no, we haven't agreed to that.
No, and he's not doing it. They're absolutely drawing the line.
Because when that was originally suggested, the British ambassador in Moscow was called in and said, if you do that, we're going to fire back. If you kill some of our guys in one of our bases, we're going to fire back and kill some of your guys in one of your bases in Britain. Mm. Yeah? Because we can. Because they've got these hypersonic missiles that can fire from Siberia. They can hit the central United States in less than 20 minutes. So they can hit anything they want anywhere in the world.
We were suggesting last week that maybe a command base like the joint NATO-US base in West London is a potential target.
They'll choose the target depending on what the British Storm Shadow missile hits in Russia.
The radar state.
They'll say, right, well, we're going to hit an equivalent target in Britain. And at that point, everything collapses. I mean, what can happen if this war takes off in Lebanon and in Ukraine is the stock market's just going to crash. Because the oil price will go through the roof. And then Rachel Reeves' great plan to have everything done with private finance will just die the death.
Is it Fylingdales out in the middle of nowhere, the ballistic missile base? That's the sort of thing. You can imagine just hearing on the news, well, Fylingdales is no more.
Well, that's because
the Russians are more likely to do that, I think, because the Ukrainians hit a
nuclear warning, you know, early warning base, did they not? And of course,
hit three so far.
So, I mean, the danger of this escalating
missile.
I doubt very much whether Storm has thought any of this through at all. I mean, when you say they come across as more adult,
do you think, Martin,
they're not more adult?
Do you think
it's just
a bit too big for him to take on board? It's like, oh gosh, I can't really get my head around.
In order to get to where they are, they have to actually, you know, basically close off a lot of the, you know, independent thinking. You don't get to be in a position like that without. And for example, he's been close to the security services all of his working life.
I mean,
life.
We desperately need is.
And
small...
basically, they say to him, "Well, this and this and the other's going on," and he just goes, "Oh yes, of course."
What we desperately
he doesn't question
need
it.
Is
he just presumes
Martin,
they know what
we desperately
about.
Need is small parties. We need new parties. We need a kind of refresh. But that just simply hasn't happened, hasn't it? Has it?
No, no. But look, we're still going to keep up the fight, and we're doing a relaunch and reorg. We're going to, you know, have a wash up, if I want a better phrase, after the election, and regather the troops. We're not going anywhere. We've built our party base. We've built our activists. We've got, you know, say you got 154 people who are prepared to be candidates. You know, that is all boding well for the Workers' Party. And, you know, we're not going to go away. And there'll be plenty for us to get our teeth into, I'm sure.
Right. Well, I want to see some of these smaller parties do well. They would, of course, do that under a PR system. We were hearing last week about 93, I think it was, MPs, if the Reform UK had got the votes under PR. And, of course, under PR, many more people do vote for the smaller parties because they realise the vote's not going to be wasted. So, but anyway, over in Wales, all sorts has been going on over there. This week we've had the resignation of the First Minister, and I spoke to Neil McAvoy about that. But before, I asked him a little bit about what's been going on in his campaign, because he explains, and I think it's well worth everyone having a good listen to what's going on actually on the ground in Wales, to see the way that small parties like his Propel, I mean, he's been a member of the Senedd for, that's the Welsh Parliament, for both the Labour Party and for Plaid Cymru, found it impossible to actually be an honest politician, an honest member of the Senedd for them both. And so he set up his own little party. That took him about a year, because there were all sorts of attempts to stop him. But he takes you through here some of the corruption that stopped this small party that Neil's tried to, you know, I would call him really the only politician with integrity left over in Wales, to explaining what is up against these small parties, and the way the establishment absolutely does everything it possibly can to fix elections, to stop people like him getting in.
I'll take you back to 2022, if that's okay, because with a new party, difficult to establish yourselves at the beginning in terms of brand. Nobody'd heard of us. We were given 6 weeks before the election in 2021 to set up and get elected. That was impossible, clearly. But we were not allowed to set up as a political party until the 2nd of March 2021. We were not allowed to call ourselves party, okay? So that's why we're called Propel. And 2022, going for re-election, and we were professionally hacked. All our data, all our up-to-date data was destroyed by somebody who really knew what they were doing. There was no, we called in a consultant. It was impossible to trace who did it. They were pretty clever in what they did. And it appeared that they were actually listening to me in my living room as well when my laptop was on. I didn't realize Wi-Fi was so hackable. I know now. Anyway. So if anyone out there wants to be slightly more secure, then use a wired connection rather than Wi-Fi. But anyway, 2 weeks before the election, this may be news to you, had a knock on the door from Children's Services, and I was under investigation. There were anonymous allegations that I'd harmed my son, and they couldn't tell me when that there were things that supposedly happened. They couldn't tell me what happened. They couldn't tell me what harm had occurred. They hadn't spoken to my son's doctor. They hadn't spoken to my son's nursery. So therefore, I do this work every day, Tony. I shouldn't have been under investigation because they should have checked with those agencies. And my son's doctor actually wrote that he felt that it was malicious because there was an election on. Anyway, I was placed under investigation. And so that really screwed up. Not only were we hacked, but I had to take care of family matters, obviously, first and foremost. And that really screwed up the last 2 weeks of our campaign. I was given the all clear on the day of the election, not the day of the election, the day they were counting the votes, midday. Oh, you're no longer under investigation. Nothing to look at. No problem at all. Thank you very much. What then happened? Before then, somebody, all I'll say to you is somebody in the know said to me, look, Neil, this is a tip for people standing for election, by the way, because I've been in politics since I was 17 and didn't know this. They said to me, Neil, look, do yourself a favor. Get yourself coded ballot box ties, right? I said, well, why is that? And this person said to me, because they cannot be cut. Now, the votes were being kept overnight anyway. So I went off and got coded ballot box ties, took them around on the night to the polling station. So I went to one polling station, gave them the ties. They were yellow, but they were coded, so nobody can cut them without my knowledge because I've got the codes. And I went to the second station, gave them the codes. They refused to put them on because they said they were the wrong colour. My colour was yellow, apparently, and I was giving them red ones, which was, I found that amusing because clearly the first polling station had contacted the second one. So they were obviously discussing it. Anyway, I told them that it was the law that if I wanted coded ballot box ties, then I would get coded ballot box ties. And I gave them four. And went around all the other polling stations, no issue. Got to the count the next day. There was one ballot box which wasn't secured with my ties, our ties, let's say. And apparently, three out of the four of the ties broke. And they couldn't put them on. We learned a lesson there again, because next time, any time we're serious about winning an election, we will supervise the ballot box ties, the coded ballot box ties being put on. How do such ties break? Three of them. Ludicrous. And that ballot box had more votes in it than came out. How does that work? This is factual. How does that work?
Yeah, well, how do you know that?
The figures were there. They couldn't add up. They didn't add up. And they said, look, there's a mistake here. We don't know where it is. I wanted a recount, and they refused me a recount because two of our candidates lost. I won, but the other two lost. So I wanted a recount because I wanted to take the other two with me as winners. I believe we could have won that election, but we were refused the recount.
I mean, this is another reason, really, that the ballot boxes should be taken straight to the count. Was there some sort of delay there?
They were left overnight.
Overnight. They were doing the same with the mayoral elections here in Bristol, and I think, I'm not sure it was the local elections. I think it may have been two. And there got to be suspicion about leaving ballot boxes overnight in a secure, who's doing the security for these places, who could get in and change things. You've got all sorts of things, like, for example, you've only got a pencil cross in many of these. That's what they give you. You can actually take your own pen and use that, but these can be just rubbed out and votes changed overnight. Campaign.
Sorry, I'm going on. I'll fast forward.
No, it's fascinating, Neil. No, I'm not criticising you at all.
So we're a new party, as I said. Anyway, in the press, there was a bit of a stink because one of the independent candidates had his leaflet delivered to the wrong constituency. That was in Newport. Didn't happen to any of the established parties. Establishment part of the Uni Party didn't happen to them. They're all the same. So anyway, I got my leaflets in, and on time. I didn't. So the team did. Everything was done. They were all batched, lovely. They started to be delivered. I was delighted. I got the leaflet through the post. I was quite pleased with the leaflet because it was more wordy than usual, but it had sort of my political CV on, and people may not have realised what I'd done over the years. So I was quite pleased with that. And then I started getting messages off people waiting for our leaflet. And then I said, look, that's okay. It's all in hand. It'll come tomorrow. And the next day it'll come tomorrow. Anyway, to cut a long story short, by the Tuesday before the election, so 2 days before, we were running out of time. And I've been chasing the post office and I was told, look, it's all fine. Everything's in hand. Anyway, the constituency of Cardiff West, I'll just name some areas. People won't know them, but you'll get an idea of how widely our leaflet was not distributed. You've got Canton, Fairwater, Kyra, Ely, Llandaff, Rada, Pontyclun, all wards in the constituency. In every one of those wards, people complained they had not received our leaflet. And they were people as well who, first of all, I wasn't too concerned because people tend to forget they've had a leaflet or it's come with their other paper, they've thrown it out. You know, they've got a very short lifespan leaflet, so I wasn't too concerned. But when people who were looking out for our leaflets didn't have one delivered, then the alarm bells were ringing. So I did a couple of social media posts on Facebook and Twitter, and I was horrified by the response. The number of people who said they hadn't got the leaflets, a number of Propel members didn't get a leaflet. My mother, Tony, my mother, bless her, was waiting for my leaflet and it didn't arrive. And the post office insist that they delivered them all. That's not true. So I'm waiting for their response now. I'm going to give it until tomorrow. If I don't get a better response off them, then I'll be reporting it to the police because it's criminal. And I was told by a helpful person from Royal Mail that the initial investigation they did was an absolute joke. And ludicrous because it was done within a few hours. And if you're going to investigate non-delivery properly, you cannot do that in a few hours. And that's what they did.
Yeah, well, so, we've had this failure of postal votes up in Scotland too to be allowed to get through, which also seemed to me to be deliberate for whatever reason, probably also, to favour the Uni Party.
Yeah.
Any other problems with the general election?
Yeah, BBC Wales, as ever, bless them. They mentioned every party standing except us. Again, contrary to election law. So we need to go to Ofcom on that. We did complain to the BBC, but Ofcom are the people, I think. Also, this is how petty it is in terms of cancellation. After the election, with the results, BBC Wales would not put our logo on the website. So the most obscure parties have their logo on the website, and we don't. And there's no explanation for that other than political bias. There was one other interesting thing as well in terms of the fairness of media coverage. One of my opponents, the Plaid Cymru Party of Wales candidate, had a conviction for drink driving, fairly recent, within the last 3 years, more than twice over the limit. And she was campaigning for safer roads. Now, she hadn't been open about her conviction. Neither had Plaid Cymru. And again, it was uncovered by Nation.Cymru and Martin Shipton, which unfortunately has a very small readership and small reach. But the BBC said that it wasn't newsworthy. And Wales Online didn't find it newsworthy either. So the two biggest media outlets in Wales decided that in an election, in somebody who they had featured on TV in different interviews as a spokesperson for Plaid Cymru, the political party. It's incredible that a person campaigning for safer roads with a secret drink driving conviction, it's incredible that that's not newsworthy. So people voted for her on the basis that they actually didn't know her full background. And again, what you have there is the institutional bias in Wales for the Labour Party and Plaid Cymru. I'll give you some examples. The leader of Plaid Cymru is an ex-BBC newscaster. The head of strategy for Plaid Cymru is an ex-BBC journalist. Actually, he's the only journalist, the first journalist that I refuse to do interviews with. I think you know I'm quite amenable. I'll do an interview for anyone. I'll always have a chat, you know. But this individual I found him to be so disreputable that in the end, I refused to have interviews with. I just refused to interview.
Hang on, when you mean disreputable, what do you mean by that? So, I mean, surely you, as a politician, have got to agree to be doing interviews. Otherwise, it would take an extreme I mean, person, as an individual, for you to, for anybody really to say no. I mean, I get it all the time, actually.
Yeah.
Here in Bristol, for example, Carla Denyer, who's the new MP, about 2 years ago, she refused to acknowledge my request for her to be interviewed on the radio in Bristol. So, you know, what is it? What was it that this guy had done? Who was he, and what had he done? To actually get you to think, no, I'm not going to do any interviews with this guy, even though he can give me massive exposure.
Yeah, well, I suppose his nickname in Wales is Aled Ap Trydydd. Trydydd is third in Welsh, because he came third in a winnable seat in 20, whenever it was. So I'm being a bit sort of catty there. But Aled Ap Dafydd, his name is. And did I use the right term, disreputable? I put it this way, I found his journalism so poor and so biased and so discriminatory that I no longer wanted to engage with him. So every time he would phone me, he would never accept my answers, would always, I mean, resurrect stories that they were non-stories. And it got to the point where I didn't want to spend 15, 20 minutes of a day talking to him, killing a story, which wasn't a story. In the end, tell you what, mate, if you want to print that, go ahead and print it, and you can deal with the consequences afterwards, okay? That was my attitude. And I just didn't want to engage. When I was going through the complaints process, I found it interesting that he knew more about my complaints than me. I was going through the complaints process with Plaid Cymru at the time. All these complaints were made against me. And I just found it really interesting. So in those days, I did speak to him, because if I wanted to find out what was going on with my complaint, I would speak to this BBC journalist, which may sound, I don't know how it sounds, but it was a bit odd, but it was working for me at the time. So, and then it got to the point where it turned out that the head of comms in Plaid was actually he was in a secret relationship with the head of comms of Plaid. So I suspect, I can't prove it, but I suspect, given that they were in a relationship, I suspect that he was getting the information from her. But of course, the complaints process was secret, secure, and she clearly shouldn't have known.
So that's Neil McAvoy from the Propel Party. He's actually a Welsh nationalist. They wouldn't allow him to give his party any kind of nationalist style name, even though, of course, Plaid Cymru is a nationalist party, and they have talking about these various methods which he's used to shut him down, really. Martin, this whole business about coded ballot box ties, I mean, the idea is that that the candidates can ensure that no one is tampering with the ballot box overnight. Quite clearly that didn't happen.
No, that was an interesting interview, but was he standing in the general election? Is that what we're talking about here?
That was local elections, I think.
So that was a local election that he was standing in, yeah? Because he said he wasn't.
Oh, hang on. No, because it was general election, because this is the general election I'm pretty sure he's talking about here, because he was talking about the various wards.
That's right.
And now you have various wards for a general election constituency.
Yeah.
You only have one ward for a local authority election.
Yes, okay, so in other words,
this is in the general election.
He stood in the general election.
His leaflets were not delivered.
Well, he said he was elected.
No, he wasn't elected.
All right, so he wasn't elected. I'm just trying to clarify factual matters.
No, anyway, and also leaflets not being delivered. Vexatious complaints process in the run-up to the actual election himself, so he's having to deal with that and not out there on the streets complaining. Constantly got this journalist guy, I think this is back in the day, actually, because he's now works for Plaid Cymru, phoning him up with attempts to do hatchet jobs on him, effectively, saying, "Do you did this? We've heard you've done that." And him having to say, "No, I didn't," but the guy not listening. So it seems to me the press is most definitely not doing its job. He mentioned these people, nation.cymru. So I will say it as well, nation.cymru. Sounds like a very good website over there. They're the ones that have exposed this drink driving conviction for one of the candidates that wasn't considered newsworthy by the main press in Cardiff. And so there are all sorts. I think, Andy, in a way, I think you must have, recognised some of the sorts of tactics there. The idea seems to me to be that the establishment, particularly through the press, is doing everything it can to make sure that people just don't get to hear that many of the candidates in the general election.
Yeah, I mean, my brief entry into this general election has opened my eyes quite considerably, and there's a lot of lessons to be learned. But you know, the whole system is very difficult to get in and get organised within, you know, to get your message out, to get be heard. It's not set up for small parties and different voices, you know, and you made a reference to PR, or a different system at least, where the voices of smaller parties can be heard. Well, I think that's essential to democracy, because at the moment they're just being shut out, and the process needs to be simplified, and people need to know that their vote actually counts for something.
Martin, I'm saying a lot of this seems to be it's stories the media will not cover, at like the drink driving offence, and also the stuff they also won't cover, which is actually getting people like Neil out there to the public so they can see who he is. Silly things like not putting his party logo, which is there on the ballot paper, it's there in adverts, it's there in leaflets, but the BBC decide they're not going to put it onto their website.
Well, I mean, we've interviewed him before, or rather you've interviewed him before, have you not? And I think he's regarded by the establishment in Cardiff because he was an ex-Labour activist.
He's an ex-insider. He's almost like Princess. He's like Princess Diana in the royal family. He's been in
he's been in Plaid Cymru.
He knows all the people who are doing all the manipulation. He knows them personally.
Yes. So in other words, and
it's a danger to them.
Well, it's a very incestuous little setup that they've got over there. You know, if you're in, you're in. Because we had a Labour Plaid Cymru government running the Welsh Senate for many years now, and if you're outside of that charm circle and you're regarded as a troublemaker, then they've got all sorts of different ways of making life difficult for you, which of course is what he's documenting.
Well, my point is it's not democracy, is it? It ain't democracy.
Well, I mean, if a first past the post vote in Wales is not democratic anyway, for the reasons that it's just been explained by Andy. But he has been able to survive within the Senate and local. The Senate elections are proportional. Local elections aren't.
But they've just made the Senate elections non-proportional again now.
Have they?
I think so.
Yeah, well, I don't think they have. I don't think they have, as far as I know. But I mean, the point is, that does give some leverage to outsiders like him. He can get elected in a proportional setup. And of course, the same thing's happened in Wales, and obviously the same thing happens in Northern Ireland, because that's the way of it, and has been since the Good Friday Agreement.
Anyway, Vaughan Gething is out. He's the ex-First Minister of Wales now. He was the First Minister of Wales since before the general election. I think it was around about May time, local election time, that the previous guy, whose name escapes me, thank God.
Drakeford.
Mark Drakeford, that's right. Great at reading a script, but you know, the idea that he's the spirit, carries the spirit of Wales, so the vision for the future, is a joke. So he says he was never accepted as First Minister. It's interesting to see him being ousted this week. And so obviously, as an insider, I had to ask Neil about what do you think's been really going on behind the scenes there with this First Minister, Vaughan Gething, being elbowed out of his job.
For the first time in my lifetime, a First Minister has faced fair scrutiny, and it's never happened before, and possibly maybe I could even name one journalist, Martin Shipton. I think maybe the sea change has been him being freed from the shackles of Wales Online and Trinity Mirror and working for the smaller news outlet called Nation.Cymru. And I've been really critical of them in the past, I think justifiably so, because when I was implied they were gave me great press. When I left, awful press, and sort of cancelled me for a while. But Martin Shipton is working for them now and has been a real thorn in the government side, and really has held Vaughan Gething to account far more effectively than any other media person, any politician. And the First Minister has just simply had to answer questions. For example, why did he take £200,000 off a convicted criminal to fund his leadership election campaign to become leader of the Labour Party in Wales? Did he see any conflict there? Did he see any conflict of interest, knowing that the day the money was given to him, the individual had made a plan and application to the Welsh Government for a solar farm? And also the fact that he was given £200,000, the Vaughan Gethin's department had signed off a loan previously to the convicted criminal for £400,000. So Vaughan Gethin has been very eloquent and maybe arrogant in saying that he's done nothing wrong and he's broken no rules, broken no laws. Absolutely correct. But he's had questions to answer. And he's come unstuck. And I think the reality is, for the first time, and let me just say, I've been on social media. I've been a big supporter of Vaughan Gethin. I'm absolutely gutted, really, really disappointed that he's resigned. He resigned yesterday because he was the first. He would have made history, in my opinion. He was a history maker because he was going to be the first Labour First Minister to take them to defeat in 2026 because he'd been rumbled. And that's the reason why they've got rid of him. Not because he's done anything wrong or has got poor judgment, simply because the wider public had cottoned on. I think there was a real feeling out there that they'd had enough, which really wasn't detected in the Westminster election because those were done on Westminster things, really. And whereas the Welsh politics were getting more and more localised, more and more national Welsh politics now. And I really think he would have lost the election in 2026. So he has gone. Four of his colleagues resigned yesterday. And he then resigned. They resigned from his government so they couldn't serve under him. And he then resigned as well. Unfortunately, I'm really gutted, to be honest.
Well, yeah. You're saying you are, but surely, I mean, this whole idea of taking £200,000 from a criminal to fund your campaign, I mean, in a way, it's almost as if he's set himself up to fail, or at least to see. I mean, you get the idea that people like this are just seeing what they can get away with rather than actually in any way a serious politicians, not even pretending to represent the public anymore.
I think you're missing one key point. He did not expect any scrutiny. He expected to be treated like every other First Minister has been treated, where things that could have been made public, things that could have got in the public domain, never did. And when, for example, First Ministers have lied in the past, they've never been picked up on it. They've been allowed to lie. And the media's repeated the lies as well. So he felt really hard done by, and he didn't know what was going on, really. He was like, well, this isn't fair, this isn't fair. Is it because I'm black, basically? So because he is black, he felt the media were targeting him because of his colour. And I think, really, he has been treated differently to other First Ministers, white First Ministers. But for me, the reason is, I believe that probably the only journalist in Wales, really, almost, Martin Shipton, has been freed of the shackles of Trinity Mirror and is now working for a publication where he can publish what he needs to publish and wants to publish. So he's gone after Vaughan Gethin, justifiably so. And they're not used to it. They're not used to the heat in the kitchen because they've never had it before. And I'm hoping that maybe it'll carry on. But they'll appoint somebody with a much better idea of PR, much more vanilla, let's say, in terms of charisma bypass. And they'll hope to calm the Welsh public and get over the line again in 2026 with the Welsh parliamentary elections. But I would hasten to add as well, I think Gething brought heat with the way that he behaved, and they were very, very uncomfortable with attention. So everybody in that bay, I call it Corruption Bay, by the way. It's not Cardiff Bay, Corruption Bay. Everybody in that cesspit will be relieved that Gethin has gone, because they will hope that they can get back to normal and have very, very little scrutiny. But we'll see whether that transpires.
So that's our man in the cesspit of Corruption Bay in Cardiff, Neil McEvoy, giving us a bit of an insight as to what's been going on over there. And again, plugging this website, suggest you have a look, folks, which is nation.cymru, C-Y-M-R-U, I think is it spelt. But it's the the whole point, really, I suppose, about and by the way, a longer interview with Neil will be up on our show page tonight, the full interview at thisweek.org.uk, just to explain, you know, gives you a really good idea, I think, of what's going on just over the other side of the River Severn. Andy, we've got to sort of find a way through this, haven't we? Because the big parties, what with Labour now in charge, they're not going to be bringing in proportional representation. The media is likely to be even more concentrated and centralised. You've got people like the Murdoch Group owning radio stations. They've got these sort of talk radio, talk TV. You've also got Times Radio, Times TV. You've got, I'm not sure if that's TV too, but anyway, you've got so many of these. So they're not. It's not just that it's a small number. It's also that each one's got fingers in every pie. So they've got they've got their national newspapers, but they've also got TV, radio. It's going to be a bit of a battle, isn't it, to get the Workers' Party established?
Yeah, well, on the proportional representation, I think it is Labour policy, and whilst it is policy. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it was passed by the Labour Party conference, but that doesn't really mean anything.
Well, thank you, yes. But going on to my my explanatory note is that, yeah, I'm not going to hold my breath. But, you know, with PR, I think you're going to need a collection of smaller parties. I know Farage is in favour, but you're going to need a collection of smaller parties. I think the Greens as well just need to push this more through Parliament. But, yeah, I don't think it's likely to happen any time soon. But, you know, I think with regards to the Workers' Party and how we deal with the media, I mean, all of our stuff pretty much is online and social media. It's small video, small recordings, educational pieces. We've really bought into the social media, TikTok, Facebook era, and that's done us remarkably well. And I kind of facepalmed, a proper facepalm, when Keir Starmer celebrated the fact that he got the backing of the Sun newspaper, you know, forgetting what the Sun has done and did do to the people in Liverpool. But I just thought, well, no one cares about the Sun anymore. You might pick it up in a greasy spoon somewhere. But the readership of papers has been going down for decades, and it'll continue to go down, and people will get their news from social media and other online outlets. And that's what I think a party who wants to get heard will need to do from now and in the future.
The trouble is, you know, you've got your tech giants throttling, and I think that's what they do. They just, well, they find out where the opposition is online in these social media, and then they throttle it down. They may make sure that it doesn't pop up on people's feeds. There's the Twitter files. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. Very good example of how Twitter makes sure that anybody that's a threat to the establishment, in whatever way, they can just simply target a specific account, like my account, maybe, but much more likely to be somebody like Craig Murray, his account. And just because I remember him writing this a couple of years ago, saying, well, suddenly my retweets have gone down by about 100-fold. So whereas I'd get several hundred retweets, I'm getting 2 or 3. And this is all done through the social media firms. Now people have bought into this as a good way of sharing information. They have now betrayed the users. They're betraying the listeners, which is a little bit worrying. Also, I think we ought to look at the King's Speech. But maybe actually before we do that, let's have a little look at this this bizarre cyber attack today. That's been, I think it's called, the company's called CrowdStrike. All sorts of Windows updates have been destroying computers, and there's a very bland message put up apparently by CrowdStrike. I haven't seen it myself, on their web page, saying, "Oh, it's okay, we've got a fix." But the thing is, if your computer won't even start anymore, how are you going to put a fix onto it? I mean, it just seems to me like, and it's nice, isn't it, also, that this has not just simply been blamed on the Russians, which, Martin, it could possibly have been done. They could have just said, oh, it's the Russians, blah, blah, blah. And funnily enough, by the way, the guy that started CrowdStrike is Dmitry Alperovich. He's an ex-Russian living in the United States. He started the company along with a guy called George Kurtz. So what do you make of all this? So the whole all the air, I mean, basically it's the baggage check-in machines, the automatic baggage check-in machines, they won't work. Quite a lot of the railways are only accepting cash because their the system doesn't work around the country. NHS appointments all cancelled because the various computer systems that the NHS use, the computer, you turn it on and it just crashes. Is it feasible? This is deliberate? Is it accidental? Surely a company will check an update before it sends it out?
Well, obviously, this is an ongoing story, and we don't have all the information yet.
Well, I've just given you quite a bit.
Well, I know, but I mean, we still don't.
That's why I try and do that. I try and give you plenty of information.
Well, I know, but
so you can decide what you want to say.
Obviously, it's not an acceptable situation where something like this can cause such chaos. But of course, that is these complex systems that our society depends upon are in fact quite vulnerable. And one of the things that may happen as we go forward into the end of this year is that if we do start fighting with the Russians are going to take down all the satellites which are, targeting their people.
Just to update you,
destroy
Martin, just to make sure you
GPS,
are you are up to date. It's a 80 billion company, and it's now being called the largest IT outage in history.
Yes, and of course, this could be just look how vulnerable we are. I mean, my sister works in the NHS, and they had some ransomware put into what they were doing, and they couldn't function for months. You know, they couldn't access their own files. I mean, it's very vulnerable. All of these systems are vulnerable. And of course, there is also the potential. They've been the World Economic Forum people are saying, "Oh, you do realise that there's going to be a cyber attack, don't you?" It's like they flagged these things up in advance, and we might have to take steps to control things after the cyber attack. So it might be that it is deliberate. I don't know, because what we may find, as I say, the Starlink system, which allows the Ukrainians to fire all their first-person view drones, the Russians may decide at some point to knock those Starlink satellites out.
They don't actually. Electronically. They don't need to actually knock them out of the sky. They can paralyze them up in space.
They do try and paralyze them electronically. They're actually parasiting on Starlink, I understand, at the moment. So they've got their own people using Starlink, because they're just getting into the system.
Well, the CrowdStrike logo is some red kind of. It looks like a kind of Starlink, actually, funnily enough, coming down to strike you. What's happened.
CrowdStrike. It's a bit of a CrowdStrike, isn't it?
I think we're all missing the most important thing here is that it's set back the cashless society for a few more years yet. Yeah. And as a man of a certain age, you know, I still carry around the folding paper in my wallet, and I haven't totally bought into the cashless society yet, which helped me shopping earlier at a well-known DIY store. You know, basically I was the only one who could pay for the stuff I was buying. Right. That's the kind of world we're living in, which is, I suppose...
So the wonderful DIY store, what they're doing is they're letting everyone come in, collect all their stuff, and then as they try and pay for it, they say, "Oh, you've got to have cash." That's a little bit unkind, isn't it, B&Q?
Possibly say.
Okay, good. Well, I'm glad you haven't confirmed or denied that. There is an element to this which is a bit, I find a little bit like the use of so much plastic everywhere, is for years and years, many of us have been saying, plastic's really terrible. In fact, even back in the 70s, as kids, we were saying, plastic's rubbish, you know. It's made in Hong Kong, it's a load of rubbish, and let's get rid of it, let's not have it. We want, metal things, and even as children, we were saying that. But now, and of course, as the cyber age has come along, these computers, everyone's far too reliant on them. I may be wrong, Martin, but I think the Russians in their Russian Air Force decided that they were always going to have some kind of manual override for pilots. So if anything went wrong with electronics of say, a fighter aircraft or a bomber or a transport aircraft, that they could basically flick a switch, turn all the computers off, and take manual control of the plane. That is like, basically with the stick connected to the flaps or whatever, or it happens to be aileron, so they can actually say, "Well, look, that isn't working. Flick, let's just do it like this."
Well, that's true. I mean, they've obviously thought a lot about electronic warfare and what you need to do to fight.
Well, this is EMP weapon. This is the electromagnetic pulse weapon. It will just knock all the printed circuits out like
that. You can see what they're trying to do in the Ukraine. They're trying to de-electrify it, which they didn't do to begin with because they're trying to negotiate. But they're now, when winter comes in Ukraine, there won't be any electricity. And of course, if you live in a tower block, you can't just start a fire.
In fact, there's whole streets in Ukraine now with loads of little generators going outside each door.
That's right. And they can't. You've got to have the fuel to run them and all the rest of it.
And by the way, deserters from the army being shot.
Well, yes, I mean, the you know,
Ukrainian army.
Yes, they've got these blocking battalions behind, like the Azov battalion, are now on currently doing a tour of Europe. Their role has been to wait behind the lines as people try and retreat to shoot them up.
With their boss in front of the British cabinet today.
Yes, that's
cabinet.
Right. But I mean, what was I going to say? They've thought in terms of, you know, how can we fight, whether, you know, their electronic warfare stuff. They knock out a lot of the GPS stuff that the West is using. It's obvious for them to do that, you know. If they're reliant on that, that's a weakness from our point of view.
So what I'm saying is we've built a society that's bound to fail with all this reliance, haven't we, Andy, with computers everywhere?
Yeah, it seems that way. I mean, this morning a friend of mine said, you know, the Terminator movie's just started, you know, it's the kind of end of days. But, you know, it is pretty much everything, even modern trains now. They're all computer systems, and
well, they were saying earlier the emergency calls. So someone you see somebody killing someone in the street, you phone the police, and you get bleep bleep bleep. I'm sorry, this service will be resumed as soon as possible.
Yeah, well, that's crazy.
Well, I mean, also, I mean, years ago, Adrian, friend of ours, he was driving a hire car to move house. It broke down. He called up the AA or whatever, and they came to look at it. And they said, the problem with this is it's the chip that's gone down, so we can't do anything to fix the car. That's we just have to tow it away.
I remember that. It's funny. But you, right. Yeah, he was on the motorway in a hire van, and the hire van said, I'm not going to do more than 25 miles an hour. So he was there going along the motorway, and he eventually realised it's too dangerous, I'm going to have to pull over, and he called the AA onto the hard shoulder, because you can't do 25 miles an hour on a motorway. But the hire van company hadn't thought of that. Or the people who designed it, that if you're going to have this thing go wrong electronically in it and force you to go 25 miles an hour, that's very dangerous to do that on a motorway. We're living in this world now, which seems to me geared for chaos.
I think, look, bad thing happens to these systems. I mean, if you think about, you know, when I was a kid, you know, my first computer was a ZX81. I don't know if you remember those, 1K of memory. But now, of course, in your mobile phone, that's all changed. And I think it's that progress and that process. I think the reliance on a system that's not yet fail safe, and especially when you're talking about, automated cars and automated trains, you know, stuff that can actually kill people in these ways. I think there's got to be a lot more scrutiny on stuff like that. And if we can, you know, if we're shutting down half the world and, our economic systems and our emergency systems because one bit of software was written incorrectly, then there's something else needs to be done, right?
Well, my laptop's working here. It's a Linux laptop. Dave has installed Linux on the laptop, so it's all working here.
Can I just say what I was? I remember what I was going to say. The Russian secret services still use card index files because that's the way to do it.
Well, yeah. I can remember
because nobody can hack a card index file.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember the report just before 9/11, Carl Cameron on Fox News talking about the way that I think it was Odigo Systems, which was an Israeli firm, and they had Israeli agents over in the United States who had access to all these phone records, and so when the FBI were phoning various people, they would be able to alert their own criminal agents to say, well, watch out, the FBI are after you, because they had access to all of these databases in the phone companies. So they were keeping an eye on the FBI. Oh, right, he's talking to him. What's he saying? Oh, he's saying that it looks like they've found our agents, and so they quickly extract their agents from the country. So this is where it's vulnerable. It's very vulnerable.
In fact,
even on 9/11, what you had was these fake planes appearing on the
as part of the exercise, supposedly,
for the radar operators, and so they weren't sure is this real plane or not on my screen. So if you can get into the operating system, you can make anything happen.
Well,
on that
one of the things that happened, the assassination of Rafik Hariri in Lebanon years ago now, it was supposedly a car bomb, and Hezbollah got blamed. So Hezbollah then had a press conference, said we don't really want to do this, it's giving too much away. But here we have the video feed from the drone which actually fired the missile that killed Hariri, because we've hacked into the Israelis' drones. We see when you've got a complex system that's surveying everybody, if somebody hacks into that system, then they've got all that data. And if they don't know you've hacked into it, then you've got all of that data, and it's totally vulnerable. And basically, the Iranians had to say that we didn't kill Hariri; it was killed by the Israelis. And the way we will prove it is by showing the thing from the drone. Oh. But of course, that meant that the Israelis then changed all their systems to make sure that Hezbollah couldn't get into the. But I mean, this, okay, is, this
so
is
what do you make to the outage? Is it an accident? Or deliberate.
Yeah,
an accident.
Martin? I think it's more likely to be an accident, but it might, you know, we just, you know, people, there's a fever.
I think we should ask Dmitry Alperovich, the co-founder of this $60 billion company, who was born in Russia. I think we should ask him.
I mean, that's suspicious in itself, isn't it? Let's face it.
I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have been writing the code. I reckon
that's right. Almost, yeah, you're probably right there. Oh, yes. Also, just briefly, looking at Leeds, last night there was an intervention yesterday afternoon by social services, apparently coming to take some children away, who there were reports that they were had been harmed a few weeks previously. The allegations are flying around left, right and centre, and there's a sort of tug of war between the authorities that say that one of the children fell out of a window, not sure how high up that was, and they got an injury. Other people saying that it was actually a scrap between two of the kids in the same family that caused the injury. But anyway, as social services turned up to take the children away from the parents yesterday, police were called because there was a whole crowd of neighbours that said, no, you're not taking the kids. What do you think you're doing? Which then led to the police car being turned over. The police retreated as there were so many people turned up. And the police car was turned over and set fire to, as well as a bus was stopped. The driver was asked to get out the bus, and the locals set fire to the bus as well. So this seems to be a mob rule style thing going on. It does look, to be honest, quite more likely to me that this is the local people who are just saying, no, we're not taking these children away from their parents. What the hell do you think you're doing? Go away. You've got some wrong information somehow, and it's just spiraled out of control. But anyway, Martin, what do you make of this? Anyway, if they wanted to put these people, what I found amazing, I've never seen anything quite like this last night, was the people who were setting fire to the bus are quite happy to do it in front of the camera. So it's waving at the people filming them. Yes, I'm setting fire to this bus, and if you want to arrest me, fine. Arrest me. But we're not having the police and social services coming in here taking kids away from their parents that shouldn't be. So it may be that there is a mob rule element, but it also might be that the social services and the police are at fault, Martin.
Well, I don't know enough about this incident to make a sound judgment, is what I would say. It could be either. But people attacking police cars and buses, I mean, you know, this has happened in the past. I used to live in Brixton.
It's called a riot.
Kind of thing.
It's called a riot.
Yes, these things happen. And they're not necessarily, you know, there's always different circumstances involved, and it's not necessarily straightforward. So I wouldn't like to pass a judgment on this. I simply don't know enough
about it. We're not asking you really to pass judgment. Just give us a view of some sort. But what do you think, Andy? It's a bit of a... cliche it might sound that the community sounds to me I mean it may be wrong but it sounds to me like the community has come together to protect this family.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. But I mean, I came from a council estate, and I can't, you know, when I seen these images on the TV, I did wonder what would get people's backs up enough to turn a police car over. I mean, I can't imagine as a young man, you know, because some of them there were young kids, right? You know, teenagers maybe, late teens. But turning over a police car, you know, surely however bad the incident, I don't know, turning over a police car seems a bit...
Oh, I suppose it's a way of telling the police, look, just back off, you know.
There's an anti-police attitude amongst some young people, and for the opportunity...
Well, they may be drug dealers. That might be their anti-police
That's right,
attitude.
Tony, so you can't presume that you know exactly
I'm not presuming anything, Martin. I hope you're not either. But I think we should, you know, it's an important thing to discuss, because we've got a cost of living crisis going out there, with tens of thousands, probably actually now hundreds of thousands of people using food banks to survive, and a government that seems to have, Andy, abandoned its population.
Well, I think that's the more pressing thing to get angry about. I mean, if people in the communities, you know, need something to get angry about, that's exactly it.
It's there in the background. Almost anything that the authorities do, you know, we're more likely to see this sort of thing go on because there's that resentment in the background.
Yeah, well, I would say I wish people would, well, not do violent things like that, but at least get angry politically, you know, make yourself politically aware. Start.
Well, we've just been saying you can't do it through the voting system. You know, this is the trouble. People want change. They want them. They don't want Starmer, who says he's going to give change, but he's going to give no change. They want real change.
Yeah, well, do what the thousands of people who've joined the Workers' Party do, and like myself, you know, you see something that you believe in, you see the politics that you want to see in your country, then get active. Vote for them, go and join them, be active within them, and organise. You know, it's like the guy you done an interview with, you know, that lone party that he found was very difficult, you know.
Neil, yeah.
Yeah, Neil. Well, Neil wasn't put off by the adversary that he faced. You know, he's cracking on. And
well, he is. And in a way, you know, he's getting publicity from it as well. He's trying to make sure that everyone knows what's going on and that people will come in behind him as a result. And I think, you know, let's be cynical about this. A lot of people just, oh, well, you know, I've got more better things to do. I don't want to get involved in politics. It's too much of a game. But you will also find, because maybe it's partly because Cardiff and Wales being like they are, there will be a lot of people coming behind him once they find out the way that they are being themselves being cheated. Anyway, look, we really ought to look at the King's Speech and Transport. I mean, you, as left, what was it, Vice President?
Yeah.
You actually drive trains yourself? This is a train drivers' union.
Yeah, I've been driving trains for 24 years, not so much recently because of my activities. On, I say, I'm not here on behalf of my union or my work, but it's certainly given me a background into the stuff I've been doing with the Workers' Party.
Yeah. So let's have a listen now. It'd be interesting to get your take on the government's attempt to, big inverted commas, renationalise the railways. Here's the King's Speech itself, and at the state opening of Parliament. And afterwards, we'll hear a little clip of one of the transport correspondents taking us through it.
A bill will be introduced to allow local leaders to take control of their local bus services. My ministers will bring forward legislation to improve the railways by reforming rail franchising, establishing Great British Railways, and bringing train operators into public ownership. Taken together, these policies will enhance Britain's position as a leading industrial nation and enable the country to take advantage of new opportunities that can promote growth and wealth creation. My government recognises the urgency of the global climate challenge and the new job opportunities that can come from leading the development of the technologies of the future. It is committed to a clean energy transition, which will lower energy bills for consumers over time. A bill will be introduced to set up Great British Energy, a publicly owned clean power company headquartered in Scotland, which will help accelerate investment in renewable energy such as offshore wind. Legislation will be brought forward to help the country achieve energy independence and unlock investment in energy infrastructure. A bill will be introduced to support sustainable aviation fuel production. My government recognises the need to improve water quality, and a bill will be introduced to strengthen the powers of the water regulator.
Well, that's the environment saved. Thank you, King Charles, saviour of the world's environment. But what about this business with the railways? He's saying that they're going to bring public ownership of the train operating companies. Now, last time I looked, they're falling like flies and one by one returning to public ownership of their own accord.
Yeah, well, that was COVID, basically. I mean, that's probably a whole different show. The COVID pandemic basically stripped the railway of all its passengers. And so they went cap in hand to the government saying, woe be us, we can't afford to run a railway anymore. The government wanted to keep the service running for obvious reasons, and so those new contracts were made to do that. And so there are a few companies, I think it's 16 companies at the moment, and some kind of government-funded contract is a bit... There's a lot of technical...
Right, so they're not making money. They're having to be subsidised. So actually bringing...
Oh, they're making money.
Oh, they are.
Yeah, yeah. There's always a written into every contract, no matter whether it's government funded or not. There is always a profit margin in it. It probably just won't be as big as it was before COVID.
Now, I thought that Network Rail was already, it used to be Railtrack, Network Rail, which is, owns the actual infrastructure, the railway lines themselves, the tracks, Railtrack, was publicly owned and controlled anyway.
Yeah, but it's, I think it's the control mechanism. The idea around GB Railways is to basically kind of bring it in under one kind of strategic.
You mean like it used to be?
Like it used to be. Back funny that.
Before it was privatised in the 1990s under the major government. The one thing he's not talking about here, bless him, King Charles, is the Roscoes. These are the people that own the actual engines and the carriages, yep. The rolling stock company.
Yeah, the rolling stock companies. They've literally invented the phrase the gravy train, I think. They've been earning a fair bit of cash. I mean, even I think when their initial conception, basically, they were invited to kind of, I think it was three main rolling stock companies were invited to take on the rolling stock from British Railways, and I think within a year, one of the kind of management companies sold up and made millions upon millions of pounds of profit within a year. The trains were bought very cheaply from BR, and they were leased back very expensively to the
But what I hear now is there's actually not enough rolling stock out there, and that quite often the train operating companies saying, right, we need two of these, whatever it is, I don't know, eight carriage trains to go from London to Birmingham, and the Roscoes just say, oh, sorry, we've only got one.
Right, that's right. Yeah,
or maybe it's only going to be three. We haven't got enough.
Well, they bought.
So they're running it. What I'm trying to say here is they're kind of running it down, aren't they? They're not keeping enough of this rolling stock ready to go.
Yeah, well, the idea. I mean, well, everybody wants to make a profit. The idea is buy something cheaply, sell it really expensively, and don't do anything with it. Right. That's kind of what's happened. Right. So. Most of the modern trains now, the modern units that are coming in, are basically bought through the government funding. Nothing to do with the train operating companies or Roscoe's, but they're bought in through people like Hitachi, for example. A big contract, multi-billion pound contract that lasts for 25 years, that's government funded, government run. So the Roscoe's don't own any of that. The Hitachi own that and then lease it back to whoever wants to run the trains.
Yeah, it's a bit like a lot of these vehicle fleets are now just leased. So big companies will just lease the vehicle, so no one's actually, nobody actually using it actually owns it. So it seems to me that makes much more sense if you own it, you control it. Also, you're not bleeding cash to the shareholders. So anyway, so let's have a listen now to one of the correspondents they had on Times Radio talking about this, because he went into some detail about what was the actual effect of the transport, and his name is Ben Clapworthy.
Starting with rail and transport, and I'm joined by the Times transport correspondent Ben Clapworthy to talk us through the plans. So, on the railways, what should we look out for, Ben?
Yes, so at the centre of Labour's plan for transport is a bold vision to re-nationalise the railways. Now, actually, a lot of that work has already happened because of the pandemic. The way traditional franchising works has been completely upended. What we have now on Britain's railway, for the very vast majority of operators, is a system whereby they are paid a set fee by the government to run a certain level of service, and they return any revenue that they make back to the Department for Transport. Now, the idea and what we're going to see in the King's speech is the creation of a new rail body, Great British Railways, which will become the controller of both the rail operating and the track and infrastructure, so subsuming Network Rail, but also the rail companies into that new centralised, nationalised body.
It's going to be quite a slow process, isn't it, getting them all into Great British Railways?
It is. So under the current contracts. The very vast majority will move into Great British Railway when they expire over the next 5 years or so. Louise Haig, the new Transport Secretary, has said, though, that she may look at terminating some contracts on poorly run operators earlier and using some clauses within those contracts to cancel them. She's particularly eyeing up Avanti West Coast, which runs services up the West Coast Main Line and has been struggling with poor performance since the pandemic. But yes, it will be a slow operation. What one rail industry sort of expert was saying to me recently is that a potential way that it'll be done is effectively setting up GBR as a shadow operation to start with, so setting up all the running of the business so that then when the contracts do start to expire, you effectively lose the shadow bit and it takes over. However, there's still a lot of unknowns in how it's going to work, and also, crucially, if it really will be the silver bullet to improving services, not least because, as we've seen in the last 2 years, the unions play a very, very strong role in the running of the railways, and the creation of this body, while they support it, is not going to change their views on what they see as red lines in terms of taking away working practices or changing the way the operations are run.
And there are actually some unresolved disputes, aren't there?
There are. The train drivers' dispute is still unresolved. That's a pay deal for 2 years, backdated to 2022, that they've rejected. Louise Haig has met with the rail unions and has vowed to try and get into a position where they can accept an offer. But already, negotiations for the next round of pay deals are starting within Network Rail and for the train operating companies, workers, people that are on station staff and so on. Those discussions are already underway for the next pay deal. So they'll be saying that given inflation has remained high since the last pay deal, although it has now obviously returned to the 2% target, that they will want another increase to take into effect that it was high still last year.
So in summary, Great British Rail is a bureaucratic reorganisation, government taking back more control, but there's nothing directly in it to actually improve the train service to the public, right?
There's not. The one thing that they're very keen on as well is removing the shareholder element. Labour are of the opinion that shareholders in the big train operating companies and the big transport groups have been taking too much of the cream, particularly given the new model. So that's why they want to do it. But what there isn't is any way, and against the backdrop of ageing infrastructure, underinvestment, successive pandemics, the pandemic where we saw successive huge bailouts, and still now the railways are receiving huge amounts of taxpayer money every minute to keep services running, and revenue has not returned, predominantly because the sale of lucrative season tickets has collapsed with the advent of home working. So there's still an awful lot of challenges ahead, and it'll be interesting to see over the course of the parliament how Labour try and frame any improvement or lack of improvement in services, because at the end of the day, while Louise Haig has taken to calling herself the chief passenger, it's actually those people that are trying to commute, particularly on certain lines in, say, the north of England, but also some in the south, where there's repeated disruption, that will be the ones that really are able to mark the homework come the end of the parliament.
Ben Tatworthy, the Times Transport correspondent, thank you.
Right, that's Adam Bolton on Times Radio going through, and I'll put a link, I'll put the full five different aspects of the King's speech analysed by these various, mostly they seem to be press association correspondents. Good, really good idea to get all them in, because they really do know what's going on, into the studio to take us through the government's programme. But Andy, we may hear something in the next few weeks about these disputes. I don't want to try and pin you down on that, because that's obviously quite sensitive between the rail unions and the new government, so there may be something there. But we were covering last week the fares. £250 return from Bath to London, an open return, so you can actually come back, say, for example, at 6 o'clock in the afternoon if you want to. £250 from Bath return. I mean, this is starting to get into the... I mean, obviously, it's price-fixing going on. They're just charging people what they think they can get away with, and they're expecting that most people who are paying those fares are just on some expense account and don't care how much they pay.
Yeah, well, that's the market economy. You know, the idea was to bring the market into the railway industry, and what they got was a market economy, and that includes, you know, drivers' wages as well. So the market rate for a train driver has gone up simply because there's competition between the companies about getting, you know, recruiting train drivers. The same with ticketing; they'll charge whatever they can, you know, get out of you. Is simply where it is.
Do you think it's feasible that we might move back towards a more of a system that serves the public, and that where people, when they're paying for a train ticket, are paying roughly what it costs to get them from A to B?
Yeah, I mean, I just the most logical thing in the world for me. You know, when you take away all of that profit, I mean, it's millions and millions of pounds profit. When you take that back and reinvest it, whether it's in lower fares or additional services in areas that, you know, are not profitable, but a service is needed there all the same. It's a no-brainer to me. And if you end all the franchises, because there's 28 train operating companies and freight operating companies at the moment, all with their own administrations, all with their own kind of business structures, with their own pension schemes.
And their own shareholders.
Yes.
And their own fat cat. Anyway, look, thanks ever so much for joining us. Hope to see you again sometime soon. I've got a little... a clip for Martin now, which is the King's Speech looks at education in the state opening of Parliament.
My ministers will seek to raise educational standards and break down barriers to opportunity. Action will be taken to get people back in employment following the impact of the pandemic. A bill will be introduced to raise standards in education and promote children's well-being. Measures will be brought forward to remove the exemption from value-added tax for private school fees, which will enable the funding of 6,500 new teachers.
This is the education part. I suppose the meat in this is the putting a VAT on private school fees in order to try and boost money available to the state sector. I'm broadly in favour of that. We'll have to see how it plays out. They need to invest more in education. They need to invest more in everything. So in many ways, I suspect what's going to happen is there's going to be quite a lot of promises. We're going to do this and this and this. And in actual practice, there won't be enough resources to do the things they want to do.
It sounds a little bit like the railways, not quite so much. But isn't it just that things like schools and hospitals, NHS and education is all down to 2008 with this massive bailout? The government just doesn't have... When you drive down... I can literally remember when they stopped trimming the trees from around road signs on A roads, motorways and everywhere else. Suddenly, after 2008, I mean, basically, we're talking here about austerity, 2010, 2011, 2012. That's when there was nobody there anymore to actually make sure that you could actually see a road sign. And as you're driving along, you can see maybe a corner of a road sign, but you've got no idea what's about to happen or which direction to go.
Well, I mean, you put your finger on...
education, you know, education is a whole part of that, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, what happened was we bailed the banks out, and, of course, we also went to war in various countries with total waste of money, and then the resources were no longer available to deal with, you know, the basic stuff that people need, like having trips to the dentist or whatever. And I can't see anything that this government is going to do, this new government, which is going to challenge the basic... setup that we've ended up in. Obviously the Corbyn government, or what was aspired to be a government, they had quite a detailed, well worked out economic program with quite a lot of detail in it. But of course that didn't manage to land it, because obviously A, they didn't win the election. And B, because although most people agreed with most of what was in that manifesto, they just didn't believe that it could be delivered, because their expectations have been lowered by all of the media and everything that's happened over the years. So I think that they're not going to be able to carry on a steady-as-she-goes approach to the economy. That's what they want to do. They're hoping that growth will somehow magically happen, but they don't see that the government has any real role in creating growth. They just expect the private sector to sort of do it, and then the government can then tax the private sector's success and use it to do, you know, pursue its own goals. But I don't think they really understand how serious the crisis is. We're not going to just be tinkering around, you know, gradually, you know, reversing various Tory cuts.
What about these things like academies, you know, the academy, well, primary and secondary schools?
They're not going to change the fundamentals at all. They, you know, where we've ended up in schools, they're not going to do anything about SATs, for example. Primary schools now spend most of the summer term doing exams, which is terribly destructive and pointless. Many kids, you know, they can't really sit down and do them, but they're supposed to, so we can measure the success of schools against other schools so that we can have a market in education. I don't see the government, this government, changing any of that, really. I don't see them taking on the vested interests in the academies. This is not a radical reforming government. And of course, they will hope to be able to just tinker along. You know, things like putting fees on private school, putting the VAT on private school fees. They hope that that's a kind of sop to teacher trade unions and so on, that they are serious. But the truth is that they're not prepared to put the resources into education, health, or any of the things that we really need, because they're just not prepared to tax the wealthy, and they're just not interested in doing that, and they don't. And you know,
you're being a little bit disingenuous. How are they going to get their hands on the wealthy's wealth when that wealth is offshore?
Well, you've got yes, and many of the places it's offshore are actually British dependent territories. There's plenty of things you can do. Richard Murphy, the Tax Justice Network. There's all sorts of things you could, for example, you could just tax capital gains at the same rate as income. So when people make capital gains on the stock market, they're taxed at a much lower rate than if they earn that income through other means.
Isn't it better to do something like a Tobin tax, where
you could do that
every time
as well.
Someone
That's
is
right.
doing one of these gambling transactions on the stock exchange, which, by the way, went down today with the CrowdStrike fail. And if anyone is interested, there is actually a fix for this now. CrowdStrike's announced at 2:30 Eastern time, I don't know what that is, in the UK time, has identified an update causing the issue and has rolled it back. In other words, that you can't actually download it anymore. But they've said that if you want to boot Windows into safe mode on the Windows recovery environment, whatever that is, but somehow if you get into safe mode, I'm not quite sure how you do that. Maybe Dave can help us. Do you know how to do that, Dave? Get your Windows to boot in safe mode?
Machines, it's F8 on the startup.
F8 on the startup. They haven't actually put that on there, but we have. Then you navigate to using the C Windows System 32 drivers CrowdStrike directory. So you go to C Windows System 32 drivers CrowdStrike directory. Locate a file that says C, letter C, dash 00000029. .sys 00000029.sys and delete it and then try and boot your computer up again. It should start. So anyway, that's the just getting rid of this little thing 29 or whatever it is, sys, and I put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. so if you want to share that with anyone that needs to get their computer up and running, get it to boot after this disaster this morning by the CrowdStrike company, there you go. You can manage to do it that way. But back to the general state of the economy, Martin. If you were Rachel Reeves now, as a radical new Chancellor of the Exchequer, where would you start? Because she doesn't really seem to have a clue.
Well, she's basically saying that she's not a radical.
And no, but if you were there in her shoes, we know she's not a radical. She doesn't know what to do. She's out of her depth, way out of her depth. What would you do?
Well, the obvious things to do are, you could let the water companies go bankrupt and renationalise them. You could say there's a whole sectors of the economy which we want to actually have in public ownership, and you know that's our aspiration. Whether we can do it in the short term or the longer term, you could reform universal credit to turn it into a universal basic income. You need to invest strongly in health and education, and you either do that through raising taxes or you borrow the money, or rather you could change the way in which you create money, because effectively what we do at the moment is we allow private banks to create money and then the government borrows it from the private banks. But there's plenty of there's a big literature about this where the government could actually create its own money, and the private banks then lose that function of creating money. They then, you know, they then get their hold on their hands on the money after the government's already created it. All of these things are feasible, and I think lots of them will be done in the end, but only after there's been a massive crisis, because there's a tendency for everybody to just carry on with what you've been doing so far. So Starmer and Rachel Reeves do not want to scare the horses. They've obviously persuaded the business classes and the financial people that in actual fact they're not going to threaten them in any way, that they're no kind of threat to them, and that has been a very important part of making them electable and all the rest of it. So they're rather pleased with themselves that they've managed to persuade the, and they're getting lots of money from business people as a result of that, and far more money than they're getting from the trade unions. The problem is that they're in the pocket of these people. And as I said earlier, one of the things they're going to do is fund an awful lot of stuff by public-private partnerships, which we know is a ridiculous way to fund things. The only reason they do it like that is because they can say that it's not public expenditure and that they're not spending public money on it. And that's supposedly a terrible thing. Whereas in actual fact, they should just be straight up and say, we are spending public money on this. It's a good thing that we're spending public money on it. But there is no problem here. But of course, in order to keep the Economist and other similar type people happy, that what they want to do is they're going to choose the most expensive mechanism for all of the things that they want to do, and that's just idiotic. And of course, it's, you know, they're going to drive into a cul-de-sac and find that they can't get out. That's what's going to happen.
They don't do things like this over the channel, do they?
Well, in France, they've got a different setup. I mean, they've always had more nationalised industries anyway, and they've still got Electricité de France. But of course, Macron has been trying to neoliberalise the French economy, but there's strong resistance on that from both the left and the right. So the National Rally, for example, who came third in the elections in the end in France, they are calling for a reduction in the pension age. So the right wing in France wants earlier retirement. The right wing in Britain thinks people should work till they drop.
Anyway, there's been elections to the French Parliament. I'm joined by Eric Simon. Eric, can you hear me okay?
Yes, it's a bit, it's not that neat, but it's okay.
Yeah, you sound great. Eric, can you just give us a rundown of what's been going on in France? And I think we're all wondering what, because Macron obviously is a massive globalist. He wants to start this war with Russia. He's quite into all that sort of thing. But I wonder to what extent these recent elections in France have shaken things up a bit.
Well, I think that on the surface, it seems that there has been a bit of a shake-up with the rise of the National Rally, the Rassemblement National. But I don't think it's going to change much, actually. I think it's a joke, really, or it's just Mickey taking, if I can use this expression, because none of the actually three, let's say, main parties, which is considered as left or far left, right or far right, and the extreme centre, we have Macron in the middle, none of them actually want to get rid of the EU, so none of them are actually really representative of what the electorate...
So are the French people want a Brexit, Frexit, like we had the Brexit? But I mean, it didn't get us very far, but the French still want something.
But the thing is, back in 2005, when French people were directly asked through the most direct democratic, because they're all boasting about democracy, you know, and the dangers of the National Rally, you know, threatening democracy. But let's figure out that back in 2005, the last, for me, real president, which was Jacques Chirac, offered French a say by organising the referendum that you have on Brexit. And French voted no to the EU constitution by 55%, which is quite a large margin, despite, just like in the UK, having the left and the right saying that they wanted to stay in. So French had a kind of a mature say. And, well, something like 2 years later, our so-called democratic representative brought us back against our will, and it's written in the French constitution that the people is sovereign, not the body of the parliament or whatever, you know. And they pushed us back into NATO and the EU. And for this, they used our non-representative. So
there's a lot of talk about Marine Le Pen and the National Front there. Is they're calling it still the Front National?
No, it's called the National Rally.
Oh, National Rally.
It's not the National Front anymore.
Okay.
It's the National Rally.
What's her attitude to Russia? Because this is seems to me the key thing at the moment. And we had the Galloway Party, the Farage Party here in our recent general election, actually bursting the bubble, saying, well, you know, this is... Galloway saying that that we would have... war within 6 months if Starmer takes over. Farage going even further and saying that the whole thing was the fault of NATO and the EU pushing eastwards.
Well, most probably. I think the US fully well know that, well, I mean, let's say the military complex, you know, industrial complex, know full well that the NATO has lost it in Ukraine. So they may play a few fools in the EU thinking that they're strong, big and strong to keep pushing for this agenda. But I don't think that, how can I say, they will ever achieve that. But we have... silly enough people to push for this agenda, but I think that they keep bragging about doing something, but deep down they know that they have absolutely no ability to do so, okay, unless the US and NATO pushes for it. But even if it does, I don't think that NATO and all the Americans controlling NATO are fool enough to start full war with Russia, because you know, it would be absolute chaos, I think.
Well, yeah, so, but the thing is, even in Vietnam, the Americans were pursuing that when it was obvious they were going to lose. They seem to just go for these wars, the same obviously in Iraq, this sort of thing, Afghanistan. They have a war, they have no intention of winning, they talk it up and talk it up and talk it up, and then they back off.
But the thing is, like, if you take Second World War, I think the very losers in Second World War were indeed Europe, you know, because we've been colonized one side by the Soviets and the other side by the Americans. So, regarding these very points, I do believe that the traitors like we have in France, we know, well, a lot of people know who Macron really is working for, so it would be probably, and the EU is exactly the same, so we probably have lunatics.
Well, so who is Macron? Come on, who's Macron working for?
Well, Macron is the financial internationalist puppet. You know, he's a Rothschild, ex-Rothschild bankers, and you know who his masters are. You know, so and he's working to keep on the destruction of the nation state called France. You know, just like you have the same people in the UK, I believe it's exactly the same plan. You know, and I do believe that the UK and France were the prime targets for the pro-EU agents, because Germany has always been, probably since the end of the First World War, financially controlled by the American interest. So what they really needed to achieve this globalist plan through the EU is the, how can I say, international finance through Germany to manage regulations and, you know, fifth column in France, both France and the UK, to bring down any resistance. And for the moment in France, very much, they're using the eastern countries, in which the how can I say, financial investors such as BlackRock have relocated all our industries. So now we kind of invaded by such economic invasion. Like we could see that in transportation and anything that's industrial production.
Now I don't know if it's fair, but I think much of Europe looks to France, looks to the French people to put up some resistance on the street, like the yellow vests, that kind of thing.
You know, it's been much I think it's just like the idea of the French Revolution. The French Revolution was made by the French people for just one day, and Bastille Day. And the very next day, the very industrial and financial powers who put weapons into the people's hands just took them back the next day. Okay, and they started to rule their way. I mean, the power structure has changed. It's not the king anymore in France, but it's the same. I mean, it's an unfair system still, you know. For instance, one of the main law, you know, that started, I think it was in 1791 or 1794, was the Loi Le Chapelier, preventing workers to, you know, kind of have joint interest in unions. That was forbidden very quickly by the French so-called revolution. And they called something called the Garde Nationale. Garde Nationale was actually a bourgeois guard, just to keep an eye on business and prevent people from, uprising, I guess. So, you know, this was just a joke. And about the Yellow Vest genuinely was a genuine movement, okay? It was from pensioners with very small pensions, small business owners supporting the heavy burden, the tax burden that's been lifted off, notably by the left, on mega businesses, you know, like tax exemptions or allowance of moving profits in tax havens, for instance. That's the left that did that, mostly. And this was a genuine movement, but very soon the state had its infiltrators, like the Antifa, you know, and with the help of the media, they completely deviated blurred genuine messages from the Yellow Vest. And then the cameras, for instance, at the beginning of the protest in France, the Yellow Vest movement was not declared. It was spontaneous from, you know, text or tweet or wherever. Let's meet there, let's do this, let's do that. So police couldn't have a hold on the situation. But very soon they brought in, through the media, infiltrators, okay, who claimed to be representative. And the government said, well, you need to declare to be fully democratic. You need to declare where you're going to do this protest, through which streets you're going to march and all. So they did this at first. And then very soon the police blocked the process or the protest or the march. And then infiltrators, people bringing chaos, destroying shops and all that. And conveniently, all this happens at the bottom of the building on top of which the media were posted. So a lot of people then saw the Yellow Vest, whose popularity was rising big time, you know, and then it went down and people didn't want to get involved with that. And then very quickly it's been labeled all far left, all far right, and extremist and dangerous and all and all and all. So, you know, this has been... But I don't think that it can be won this way, anyway. Right. Because we don't have media informing us. Okay, they're controlled by the big billionaires, and so many people rely on this fake.
Well, no, I mean the interesting things happen. Just as you said, spontaneously, people saying, "Right, we're going to go and do this." They don't care about the press.
Sorry.
They don't care about the press. I mean, the Yellow Vest initially just got on with it, didn't they?
Yeah, initially, yes. But then it got divided.
They were kind of corralled, I think you're saying. Anyway, look, what about politics over there? What you're saying with the recent elections sounds to me a bit like what's been going on here in reverse. In other words, it's a flip over towards the right in France, but... with a more nationalist parties having more seats, but actually the same old thing. I mean, it's exactly as what's been going on here. We've had a so-called flip to the left, but actually the same people still running things.
Well, sadly, I don't think you can call Starmer left at all. I mean, if you think about left as working class protecting their rights, I don't think Starmer is actually Starmer. So I did it with the kind of a German accent, but I don't think Starmer could actually be called left at all. I think he's some kind of a Blairite, and he's got nothing to do with the working class. He doesn't know what the working class is. But anyway, they probably worked hard to destroy it, just like they did in France, by deindustrializing the country. But first of all, we have to understand how the French system now works. To be presented at the general election for the presidential election, okay, you need to have 500, let's say, godfathers or backers, which usually are mayors of, it could be big cities or small cities or villages, you know. You need to have 500 of them to be capable, to be allowed to be presented before the election, you know, on the ballot poll. So, for election. So before that, any backers could help you to become a presidential candidate, and the way they were backing you was anonymous. In 2016 or 17, well, 16, I think it was, and it was the left as well, under President Hollande government, they changed this and they didn't make it anonymous. And for instance, on the 2017 general election, before that law just got into action, you had one candidate which was called François Asselineau of the UPR party called Union Populaire Républicaine, who was the sole true representative of the 2005 votes, okay, who openly was asking for opt out of the EU and of NATO, first thing, and of the Euro as well. So this guy got at least these 500 backers, I'd say, to become a presidential candidate. Okay, but with this law, a lot of pressure has been then brought on the people, on the mayors, the backers, the godfathers, I'd say, who were about to help him to be presented before the electorate. And they all said that they received massive pressure. So actually in 2022, no candidate was actually the one of the 55% of the French people who openly wanted out of the EU. So in 2022, there's been no voice at all for Brexit.
Oh, amazing. Okay. Well, look, you mentioning there, it's interesting, the three things, NATO, the European Union and the Euro, the idea of extracting yourself from these lock that you've now gotten into. What about De Gaulle? I mean, De Gaulle did quite a lot, didn't he? Although he's accused of being a right-wing, far-right nationalist, he did quite a lot to get him. In fact, he pulled the French out of NATO back in the 1960s, I think, what maybe it was.
Yes, well, I think, yeah, it's a very good point, because if you actually analyse what De Gaulle did before this so-called revolution in 1968, okay, the French 1968 revolution, supposedly, in 1966, De Gaulle, quit NATO and asked the American to leave the French territory. In 1967, he openly sided with the Arab League against the Zionist aggression against the Israelis, okay? And at the same time, he passed a law because he felt, and in 1966 as well, he was the first among the Western leaders to recognize communist China, okay, and to start relation with them. And at the same time, De Gaulle passed a law which, shared a bit of the profits of the businesses with the employees, actually. Okay, and this law is still in action in 2024. It's called Participation aux Bénéfices. So that was a law made by General De Gaulle. So at the end, just before this cold revolution, because I do believe, because we know that a lot of these promoters of this 1968 revolution, which led to General de Gaulle's departure in 1969, and he died in 1970, were actually backed by the CIA, you know. And who are they today? They were the ones that were promoting Macron's election, like a guy called Daniel Cohn-Bendit. And funny enough, one of the guys today who is supposedly representing the new rise of the Socialist Party in France is actually the son of one of Daniel Cohn-Bendit's good pal, who was André Glucksmann, is today Raphael Glucksmann. Okay, that's his son. And it's funny enough, of that he's ex-Trotskyist in the 1960s, supposedly more left than the working class left. The left thinkers, or like you could call them Dostoevsky's demons, okay, are now the ones, 50 years later, pushing for all US empires war all around the world. So that's the left, just like Starmer in 2024. Okay, they all want to go for Ukraine. And for instance, if you take this kind of a switch, and they still call themselves the left, and the epitome of democracy, the quintessence of democracy, you know. This guy, Glucksmann, he supposedly claims that he's Jewish, okay? He married, actually, the Home Secretary, the Ukrainian Home Secretary that brought officially, the Azov Battalion inside the Ukrainian Home Home Office. And these guys call themselves Jewish as soon as you tap them, but they married the very one who dealt and reintroduced, officially introduced the Azov Battalion within the Ukrainian.
Well, yeah, I mean, many are called Azov and Nazis. I mean, they aren't even neo-Nazis. They are Nazis. They support the Nazis. They're not sort of even bothering to pretend that they don't. Anyway, so look, just finally to wrap up, Eric, whereabouts can people follow you? And can you just give us a brief projection of where you think French politics is headed now?
Well, I have not really done anything like this at the moment. I have something in which I do my kind of private investigation on a few matters, notably how probably Macron's secret network, some of them probably not even known by the French services, are helping to probably take out a few of the nuclear materials out of the nuclear plants that he's trying to reform at the time in France. And
whereabouts can we find? I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. How can we find that?
It's an odyssey, and it's called Roi Colin Roquebrune. So it's Roy Colin Roquebrune, which is, if I spell it, R-O-Q-U-E-B-R-U-N-E. Okay, so that's Roi Colin Roquebrune. I will do something a little later in time, in English, I guess.
We can always use one of these translation services. But okay, so finally, where's France heading now? Where do you think? And you know, what's the direction? Is there any chance of the people getting their views felt through this new election or not?
I think France is heading nowhere except the EU and the globalists want them to go. Okay, because actually, you have three. Parliament's like a hung parliament, like that. This is the expression, I guess, in English. It's a hung parliament because you will have one thing like a third left, a third at the centre, a third on the right. Okay, so no laws can be passed. So the things like you will have Macron, like the third way, one day giving a bit to the left, the next giving a bit to the right, okay, and making sure that the left and the right remain divided, okay, and keep barking at each other while the globalists and the EU regulation, because actually in France, in the parliaments, 80% of our law are just transcription of what the EU or the EU Commission decides. So, but being back to De Gaulle, after the Second World War, De Gaulle had the very, how can I say, thorough judgment on what happened, what led to the catastrophe of the Second World War. And when you mentioned earlier on what was happening, what is happening with Ukraine and the potential role of the EU, De Gaulle said that because of the fight, the st- futile fighting between parties. None of them actually thought about France as a country and just checked out what was going on. And that's exactly what's going to happen. They keep fighting. I mean, if you witnessed the low-level quality of the debate of such a crucial election, which is the parliament election, okay, which is sometimes even more important than the presidential election, okay, it was just like it beggared belief in absolute decadence. The only word was not about the 200% GDP public debt, or where it comes from, and when Martin Summers mentioned money creation system, I mean, we could change that instantly, just like Trump wants to end the Ukraine war in 24 hours, okay? We get rid of this system, we don't pay the debts, we explain to the French people how much they've been robbed for 40 years, because actually the money creation system is in France, you know, giving this over to private sector, okay, and they lend money on us with interest, the money that they create out of thin air, dates back from 1973. The president then was Georges Pompidou, who was what? An ex-Rothschild banker. So 50 years of this law brought probably Macron now to sell France to the pound, and Macron is what? An ex-Rothschild banker, anyway. So the thing is, if you talk about the EU, the guy that wrote the economic and financial parts of the EU, okay, was the finance minister of this ex-Rothschild banker called Pompidou. The name is Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. He wrote the economic parts. Actually, he wrote it at the Bank of International Settlements. That people do not know about that. So, actually, the 1973 banking law, okay, allowing private sector to create money instead of the state, has been transcribed by the same man who was finance minister in 1973 in the EU constitution, but namely by Article 123. Okay, so that's no coincidence, I guess. So we are trapped into that as long as...
So is there any chance? And one interesting thing I did read around the French elections was this idea of having a 90% tax on the rich.
Well, who said that? I don't think it's never, ever going to happen at all, you know. And the thing is, why taxing people when we can get rid? What it's okay to have taxes, to have the government and anything that goes with it, social services, to run. No problem with that. But why increasing taxes to actually bring this taxpaying money or hard-working people money whenever you're an employer or you're an employee, okay, into theft's pocket? Because public debt is just a massive fraud, you know? So the thing is, like, the left always proposing to tax, tax, tax. No, I say release the economy, get rid of the theft, okay? Increase wages instead of paying taxes, you know, that's the real solution, that's what they...
Well, you may well be right. Yeah.
You know what the left has done, or Macron has done, is now allowing to pay public debt, the government to dig deep into our own private bank accounts and savings directly for the banks under the guise of this fraud, which is money creation system.
Well, I think that's a brilliant point to end on. Thanks ever so much, Eric, for joining us live. From where are you?
I'm in France. I'm in, let's in Burgundy.
Lovely. And I'll put a link up to your Odyssey channel too. Thanks ever so much, Eric.
You're welcome, Tony. Thank you very much.
For so long, what's a woman when a Should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you've got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine, the next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. Decisions bugging me.
Decision, they molest us.
If you don't want me, set me free.
Set me free.
Exactly whom I'm supposed to be. Don't you know which clothes even fit me? Come on and let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? If I go, there will be trouble. And if I stay, it will be double. So you gotta let me know. Should I cool it or should I blow? Should I stay or should I go now?
The streets are lined with camera crews. Everywhere he goes is news. Today is different. Today is not the same. Today I'll make the action. Take snapshot into the light. Snapshot into the light. I'm shooting into the light. 4 miles down, the cavalcade moves on, driving into the sun. If I worked it out right, they won't see me or the gun. 2 miles to go, they're clearing the road, and the tyranny must really radio, I can hear what's going on.
Peter Gabriel there, that from his third album, I think it was Peter Gabriel 3, called Melt, with a picture of his face melting on the front. I remember that very well. Fantastic. And isn't it interesting how we never hear anything from the great Peter Gabriel anymore? He's a big supporter of Palestine, funny that. Welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The music you heard there was from Vaya con Dios, and the actual song is called Man Without a Woman. It's The Clash, of course, Should I Stay or Should I Go, which is hovering over, playing the theme tune to Joe Biden right now. But obviously the final track there, it's called Snapshot by Peter Gabriel from 1980 album. The Peter Gabriel 3, that is quite clearly the big news of the week. It's possibly the big news of the year, the decade. Amazing. Martin, what did you make of this? I don't know, you probably picked it up on Sunday morning, the attempt on the life of Trump.
Well, obviously, lots of theories already circulating about what happened and how it happened.
What did you make of it?
Well, it's certainly at the minimum you could say that the Secret Service didn't do what they were supposed to do. I mean, the guy shouldn't have been able to get into that position to take that shot. I mean, even they have to admit that that shouldn't have happened. Now, that means that Trump supporters are pretty much convinced that the whole thing was basically a put-up job. I'm not so sure whether that's so. Ron Unz, who I take quite seriously. He's saying that, that it's quite more likely that this kid, don't forget, Trump has been demonised in the liberal media in the US a lot. So he's regarded as a potential fascist. We've got to do something to stop him and all the rest of it.
Yeah, maybe this is how we should start, is to look at this. I mean, it's been going on a tremendous amount. Last year, this is the a clip from the TV New Zealand breakfast show where they... presenters took it in turns, this is a news program by the way, took it in turns to use a little pop gun to actually shoot a model of Donald Trump on live television in New Zealand.
Okay, Donald Trump's here, so let's say Donald Trump.
It doesn't hurt.
Put him down there. Does it have a laser?
I'm not sure it's actually that far.
I feel like there needs to be a laser on this thing. Or do you,
well, okay. this is...
Oh!
Hey!
That was huge. We gotta get rid of these guys. They're coming into our country.
Hang on.
Sorry.
Okay,
so
one more shot, and then
this could potentially be.
And then we're putting the bugger salt away.
This is fun. But I shouldn't have.
There you go.
Who thought you'd be the dad?
Chemicals sprayed my house.
It's quite salty already.
Yeah.
Riveting television.
Good. I can't do the pump action.
Well, you got it.
Go.
You have a go. But it'd be quite good for dinner parties, wouldn't it? I need a bit of salt on that. Yeah.
Yeah, see, look. Here you go.
Plenty of salt there, isn't
there? Yeah.
Yeah, and that's probably the biggest thing, right, is the cleanup afterwards.
The salt everywhere. Yeah.
But it does good the trick. Fun. If you work on your target practice, obviously.
Yeah.
So get a little Donald Trump doll.
Yeah.
And go hard. Just don't shoot other people.
No.
Well, that's the state of the television in New Zealand over there. That was last year, 2023, that they had that. And there were some complaints about it, obviously, and apologies and that sort of thing. More recently, we had the interview with Vladimir Putin, Martin, where actually Tucker Carlson said that he believed that this is what was going to happen, an assassination attempt on Donald Trump. He was taking it seriously, much more than these people who were having a joke about it.
Yeah, well, they've also, Budanov, who's the head of the Ukrainian Secret Services, has said that they've already tried to assassinate Putin several times. And, of course, plenty of politicians in the West have called for him to be assassinated. Now, this is the kind of world we live in. And, of course, US presidents and presidential candidates have been assassinated quite frequently in the history of the country. So in a sense, it's not really that surprising. It's just another assassination attempt. Reagan was nearly assassinated. JFK was assassinated. RFK was assassinated. John F. Kennedy Jr. was assassinated. Martin Luther King was assassinated. And of course, the Russians look at all of this and say, gosh, you claim to be a democracy, but a lot of people end up dead in your democracy, don't they? And of course, the whole world knows that that's how the United States is run. It's a gangster state.
Let's just look at the UK for a minute, because we did have two very suspicious deaths within the Labour Party, didn't we? I always remember on Newsnight, Ken Livingstone, the former Mayor of London, one of the very much potential leadership candidates for the Labour Party, saying, well, it's my grassy knoll moment, when he was standing for mayor the first time, because there was so much political pressure on him. But John Smith, the Labour leader, he died in suspicious circumstances in his flat in the Barbican at a very important time, just to allow Tony Blair to take over. And then, of course, we had the strange death of Robin Cook. So it could be that the whole idea of assassination is completely normal here in the West.
Well, I think it is. And, of course, if you sit in a pub in West Belfast, everybody will say, yes, of course it is.
Why in Belfast?
Because there's been loads of people killed, like Cathy McCarthy was killed in Belfast, in Queen's University Belfast Bar. She was 23 years old. Her own people thought she could probably end up being a president of Ireland, but she ended up dead. And, of course, this does happen in the United Kingdom. It happens in the United States. It happens all over the world. In actual fact, politics is a very dangerous game in certain circumstances.
Well, Sir David Attenborough was speaking about Donald Trump back in around about 6 or 7 years ago. I'll put a link up with all this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of course. He said, we should shoot him. It's not a bad idea. What alternative do we have? Do we have any control or influence over the American elections? The Naturalist says, before joking about an alternative solution. Well, we lived through that with earlier presidents. They've been equally guilty. But what alternative do we have? Do we have any control or influence over the American elections? Of course we don't. Adopting a hushed tone, he said, we could shoot him. it's not a bad idea, before chuckling. That's Sir David Attenborough, obviously very close to King Charles. The idea here is, Martin, that to save the planet, we've got to shoot Donald Trump. And this has most definitely been put out there over the last decade or so.
Well, certainly the rhetoric by his opponents has been of that kind. But then, of course, his own rhetoric is pretty overblown as well. I think the problem with US politics now is that the system is broken. Whoever wins this presidential election, the rest of the world is going to have to go to war with the United States of America, because the position on Israel-Palestine, for example, is absolutely genocidal. Whoever wins, they're going to support genocide, and the rest of the world isn't going to stand for that. And somebody will eventually, the rest of the world is going to gang up on the United States of America like they ganged up on the Axis.
What about the Russians? Maria
II.
Zakharova came out with a statement earlier during the week. Bobby Kennedy Jr., she says, son of Robert Francis Kennedy Jr., regarding the failure of the US Special Services to protect a presidential candidate. Unsecured rooftop 150 yards away. Multiple witnesses saying they were screaming at Secret Services and the police for 3 to 4 minutes as they watched a guy with a rifle crawl to the spot and line up his shot. Take your Secret Service and shove it up your bleep bleep. Prayers to Trump and his family. That's Maria Zakharova. Yep. The Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs also said, dear Bobby and the not-so-dear Congress persons who support and vote for weapons supplies to Zelensky in the United States, maybe it would be better, she said, to use this money to finance the US police and other services that are supposed to administer law in the United States. She also said Budanov, one of the heads of Kiev regime, publicly admitted, as you said, Martin, Ukraine intelligence services have made attempts to assassinate the Russian President Vladimir Putin. So this assassination attempt was made once again with the use of American money, without which the main Directorate of Intelligence, the Security Service of Ukraine, and the Presidential Office in general would not have been able to carry out their malicious activities. So, yeah, interesting, isn't it? And though through its massive funding and uncontrolled arms supplies, Washington's created a terrorist structure in Ukraine, the Kiev regime, a machine that carries out assassinations, bombings, and acts of terror against both political figures and civilians. The website Mitrovets, which is protected by the Americans, deserves special notice. It's a hit list for journalists and public activists. So this is official, isn't it? The Americans are actually, they've got a hit list out there. They're saying, look, this is fair game. Let's just kill these people. It looks as if maybe Trump was just unofficially added to the list.
Well, maybe, but of course, there are the circumstances surrounding this particular assassination, which is looks like a lone wolf, but we can't be sure.
But she's very sensible, Zakharova. She says, yeah. The United States of America must carefully reevaluate its policy to incite hatred towards political opponents, countries and people, as well as sponsor terrorism. The bell has already tolled now in Washington. And so the Russians seem to have a very mature and a sensible approach to all of this. They're saying, look, just stop inciting, you know, as I was saying earlier, you've got this, you know, Gaddafi has to go, Assad has to go, Putin has to go, Saddam has to go. This whole idea that the Americans can just interfere around the world by calling for the head chopping of a political leader in a foreign country. This is where we are now.
Yes, but of course Trump himself gave the order to assassinate General Soleimani in Baghdad.
Actually, I think Eric Simon would say that this was done and then just told to Trump we've
done
it.
That's right. So in other words, Trump, although he officially signed off on it, probably just told what to do, and he did it because it was told by the Israelis. Now, so
what can he do if an assassination? I'm not saying Trump's a great guy, right? Please don't. But it may be that these sorts of things are just presented as a slam dunk. We've just got the opportunity to do this. Do you want us to do it? Might be, but it might just be we've just done
it. Well, I mean, the effect of it has been to virtually guarantee that he will win the election in November. So he can't be complaining too much.
Well, you can't guarantee anything. The guy nearly got his head blown off, really.
Well, he could, really, yes. And, of course, we could all have a nuclear war before we get to November 5th.
No, Martin, we're talking about an assassination attempt. We're not talking about a nuclear war.
No, but
we're talking about a specific incident that happened last Saturday evening.
Yes, I know.
We're not talking about... you're trying to obscure the discussion and say, oh, well, we could have a nuclear war. We could have a nuclear war tomorrow. We could have a nuclear war now. The entire economy could go down. It's totally irrelevant when it comes to Trump.
It is, but of course the assassination of JFK is very important in this particular context.
It'd be nice to know what James Files makes of
it. Well,
this.
Indeed. So in other words, this doesn't look sophisticated, by the way, assassination attempt as what happened in 1963.
I did try this week to get hold of James Files. Yeah. He is still alive. He's the guy that blew Kennedy's head off.
Anyway, if I was a Trump, he was a bit of a
sharper shot than this fella.
Yes. And if you were going to have somebody to assassinate Trump who has been sent to assassinate him, you'd probably get somebody who could actually get him with the first shot, because it's actually not that difficult a shot.
Well, no, it might not be very easy to get a professional to do a job
indeed.
Like that.
So, in other words, all these questions are still open.
Yeah.
And I think Trump supporters are quite rightly asking, why did it? I mean, the police went up onto the roof and said, and he pointed the gun at them, and they went down again and got off the roof.
So apparently, there's obviously, well, they haven't got radios, these cops?
Well, I mean, in other words, this kind of total incompetence stroke, let it happen, that's bound to raise suspicions that something untoward has gone on.
Anyway, let's have a listen
In any case, I'm not in favour of people doing stuff like this. There's nothing.
What do you mean?
People shouldn't just go around assassinating people they politically disagree with.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Right. Yeah. Donald Trump, his speech we're going to have a listen to now just before the shooting. Sorry, there's a little bit of music in the background. But here is what Trump was saying just before the shots rang out. Thought it'd be interesting to listen to what he was talking about, because a lot of the focus has been on the events itself.
We have criminals, we have drug dealers, we have people that should not be here, and it's much tougher than if it happened. We had the strongest border ever. In recorded history, we had the best border. In fact, if they could ever put up a chart, I don't know if they can do it. Do you guys have access to that chart that I love so much? You don't mind if I go off teleprompter, do you? Because these teleprompters are so damn boring, I try and explain that. Oh, there's it. Wow. You guys are doing it. They're getting better with time. My guys, take a look at that chart. Take a look at the arrow on the bottom. See the big red arrow, right? So that's when I left office. That was the lowest point, and that comes right from the government services, comes right out of Border Patrol. Take a look at that. So that arrow is the lowest amount of illegal immigration ever in recorded history into our country. And then the worst president in the history of our country took over. And look what happened to our country. Probably 20 million people. And you know, that's a little bit old, that chart. That chart's a couple of months old. And if you want to really see something that's sad, take a look at what happened.
So the screams there presumably are people watching as the assassin had his basically head blown off virtually. I mean, he's certainly shot in the head by one of these people eventually. But there's two aspects to all of this, it seems to me. How did the guy get access to this point? And secondly, why was there no action after he'd been discovered? Several minutes he was on the roof. Apparently he was on the roof for 15 minutes. Yep. The alarm had been raised 4 or 5 minutes before he started taking shots at the president. I mean, it does look as if there's two massive mistakes that the Secret Service have made here. Oh, and by the way, the boss of the Secret Service still hasn't been sacked. But anyway, what do you make of these two aspects? First of all, a shooter given a clear opportunity, and secondly, no action being taken despite the alarm being raised that someone was trying to kill the president.
Well, I understand that the sniper who actually shot him actually had him in his sights for several minutes and was asking permission to shoot, but he wasn't given it. Now, all of these things will be grist to the mill of Trump's supporters. They're going to bang on about this, quite rightly. And they're going to suggest that the state has failed here, or that the state is somehow involved here. Now, that's not an unreasonable thing for them to say. I'm not going to go there myself, because we still don't know the full details. It seems odd to me that this boy, very isolated, apparently was bullied at school. He didn't seem to have any strong political opinions of any kind. It's not quite clear to me how he would...
Did you hear the Peter Gabriel song?
Yes, well, yes.
Well, because it's actually talking about this kind of someone that feels kind of lost at that age in their life.
That's right.
Trying to make an impact by getting onto the news.
Yes, okay. So and what Ron Unz was suggesting, and I think this is probably the most straightforward explanation, is he's the sort of kid who's been exposed to all of this anti-Trump propaganda, and he's decided that he's going to take the law into his own hands and get rid of Trump. Now, that seems likely. That's, you know, that's probably what motivated him.
Yeah, and he was a donor to the Democrats, but then he swapped sides and he joined the Republican Party in order to try and campaign against Trump from within the Republican
Party. All right, but all of this suggests that he's a lone wolf acting on his own. But the fact that the Secret Service didn't stop him, didn't kill him before he started to shoot, all of this suggests that there's more to this than just
him. His parents had phoned the police hours before the shooting took place. Saying, well, we can only assume, they haven't told us the details of the phone call, but I would imagine it's my gun is missing, because he'd taken his father's gun.
Yes. Well, he also walked to the place carrying a ladder with the gun and wasn't stopped. I mean, you know, it's all very suspicious.
So he put the ladder there, did he?
Yes, he brought his own ladder. Yeah. Now, anyway, all of this stuff, this is what a proper police investigation should
be looking into. So Kimberly Cheadle, who's the head of the Secret Service, she said, oh, we didn't have anybody there because it was a slightly sloping roof and it would be dangerous for my agents. They might fall and hurt themselves.
Well, if that's the case, you don't let anybody else up there, do you? And if you see somebody up there, you say, come down or you shoot them or whatever. I mean, the fact is he was able to get up there and they knew he was up there and they did nothing to stop him, even though he'd got a gun. I mean, that doesn't suggest... that's either incompetence or more than incompetence. And I'm quite sure plenty of Trump supporters will see more than incompetence.
So this Thomas Crooks guy, you think he really was a lone wolf? Or because the FBI have seemed to have created almost a deliberate little place for him to go there.
Yes, well, I mean, this is the issue, isn't it? People can be brainwashed to do things. We know that. I mean, the guy assassinated John Lennon couldn't remember that he was there. Sirhan couldn't remember what happened when he assassinated RFK.
If he's decided...
In actual fact, they didn't do the assassination.
He sucked up a lot of this propaganda about Trump. We want to kill him. We've got to get rid of him to save the planet and blah, blah, blah. He's a racist. He's a Nazi. This is another aspect. There's a lot of the US politicians saying the guy's a Nazi and comparing him to Hitler. This sort of thing. As a young man, you know, it's quite understandable that someone will chew that sort of stuff up and then think to themselves, right, well, I'm going to be a hero and get rid of Hitler.
Yeah, that's the very, at the minimum, the Democratic politicians in the US who've tried to demonise Trump in this way, they're now in a bind, because they were actually, you know, they had got loads of attack adverts on Trump. Trump's, you know, all the things you were saying, he's a new Hitler, etc. But they've had to bring all those adverts that they were going to run back in-house, and they've had to reconsider what sort of language they're going to use.
It reminds me of Diana, because there was all the press for months and months that had been attacking Princess Diana until she died in the car crash. And in fact, there's a brilliant private eye page which I put on my Bilderberg website. I got hold. In fact, they withdrew the newspapers that morning because most of them had been printed and distributed, but they actually withdrew them. But many people trying to buy a newspaper the next day, there wasn't a newspaper. A lot of them were reprinted with the attacks on Diana taken out, but Private Eye did a brilliant whole full page in the next edition after Diana's death of all the things that the papers were saying about Diana that day that they then got rid of. It's the same kind of thing. It's Diana has to go, Trump has to go, Assad has to go, Putin. That's all these people seem to be able to come out with, is somebody out there is the problem and not them.
Well, that's right. And of course, on the fundamentals, like the genocide in Gaza, Trump is no worse than Genocide Joe. I mean, they're all, and RFK Jr. is exactly on the same page. Incidentally, Biden has agreed to increase state security detail on RFK, because he wasn't being protected.
Okay, so that's
by the
very
Secret
nice
Service.
Of him. Very, very nice of him. Even
well,
if he
isn't. Trump called for it. He said RFK needs to.
Well, exactly. Why hasn't Biden done it? It's interesting that Biden and the whoever's in charge of Homeland Security, these are two figures who could have instantly sacked Kimberly Cheadle, who was in charge of the Secret Service. But no, she seems to be carrying on in her job. I just find that almost impossible to believe. Let's have a listen to her now.
What was your reaction when you saw the events unfold on Saturday?
Shock, and then concern, obviously, for the former president. This is an event that should have never happened.
who is most responsible for this happening?
What I would say is that the Secret Service is responsible for the protection of the former president.
So the buck stops with you?
The buck stops with me. I am the director of the Secret Service. It was unacceptable, and it's something that shouldn't happen again.
The president and Homeland Security Secretary said today they had 100% confidence in you, but there are some members of Congress calling on you to resign.
I appreciate the secretary's comments, and we're going to continue to be transparent and communicate with people.
Do you plan to stay on? Absolutely.
I do plan to stay on.
Well, there you go. I have 100% confidence in an idiot. Well, not an idiot, someone who has just completely fallen down on the job. So she carries on in her job. Listen, if Biden was in any way, or this government were in any way, had any kind of integrity, they would have sacked her straight away. But this tells me something. The fact that they haven't tells me that they wanted Trump dead. They were rather disappointed that it didn't work.
I think that's a conclusion that can be drawn. I think that puts the US on the brink of potential civil war.
Yeah.
But they've got nuclear weapons and they're a threat to everybody else at the same time. And whoever wins the election, there's probably going to be a Middle East war, and the whole world is going to have to gang up on the Americans. They've got 800 bases all over the world. Well, those are going to come under attack. And this is probably going to happen before Christmas.
Yeah, well, obviously somebody somewhere doesn't want Trump to be in charge of all of that for whatever reason. But look,
From the point of view of the deep state.
Yeah, he's not been
US.
To Bilderberg.
He's too flaky.
Which his running mate has, by the way. J.D. Vance has been to the Bilderberg conferences. Trump is a bit of an outsider. But my idea is that, you know, the way I see it is the deep state, the financial oligarchy, the military industrial complex, they think that they, and in fact certainly when he was first elected, they think that Trump is the kind of guy they can press his buttons a bit and he'll do this and he'll do that. They can maneuver him. He's very kind of easy to predict what he'll do. And but now he's a different character, isn't he? He's been into the top job, and if he was to get it again, he might actually do something useful with it. And in fact, he might sack a lot of these people. He might close the CIA down, for example, blow it into 1,000 pieces, which is what JFK said he threatened to do. Anyway, look, let's have a listen to the red-haired guy, because he was one of the most fascinating people. And when it came to Sunday morning, all those who were listening out and heard this thought, wow, okay, so there really was a deliberate kind of accidentally on purpose. They made sure that there was a nice space for a shooter to turn up and try and literally try and kill President Trump.
Right, we couldn't see him, but we could hear him. So we walked up, and probably 5 to 7 minutes of Trump speaking, I'm estimating here, I have no idea, you know, but we noticed the guy crawling, bear crawling up the roof of the building beside us, 50 feet away from us. So we're standing there, you know, we're pointing at the guy crawling up the roof.
And he had a gun, right?
He had a rifle.
A rifle.
We could clearly see him with a rifle, absolutely. We're pointing at him. The police are down there running around on the ground. We're like, hey, man, there's guy on the roof with a rifle. And the police were like, huh, what? You know, like they didn't know what was going on. You know, we're like, hey, right here on the roof, we can see him from right here. We see him. You know, he's crawling. And next thing you know, I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, why is Trump still speaking? Why have they not pulled him off the stage? I'm standing there pointing at him for, you know, 2-3 minutes. Secret Service is looking at us from the top of the barn. I'm pointing at that roof, just standing there like this. And next thing you know, 5 shots ring out.
So you're certain that the shots came from that guy on the roof?
100%. 100%.
And he was up there for a couple of minutes.
He was up
there.
You
saw him up there for a couple of minutes.
Absolutely. At least 3 to 4 minutes.
And you were telling police and the Secret Service?
We were telling the police. We were pointing at him for the Secret Service, who were looking at us from the top of the barn. They were looking at us the whole time when we were standing by that tree.
Could they see
binoculars?
Could they see him?
Probably not, because the roof, the way the slope went, he was behind where they could see. But why is there not Secret Service on all of these roofs here? I mean, this is not a big place.
Did you see, I mean, obviously everyone, when the shooting started, everyone was very panicked. Did you see what happened to him at all?
Oh, yeah, they blew his head off.
Okay, sorry.
Secret Service blew his head off.
Okay, just be careful, because we don't quite know who's watching, but you're pretty sure they shot the guy?
Absolutely, 100%.
Okay.
Yep.
You saw that happen?
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And did you see them go up to him afterwards, or?
They crawled up on the roof. They had their guns pointed at him, make sure he was dead. He was dead, and that was it. It was over.
So, redhead guy, I'm not sure of his name, but Gary O'Donoghue, great interview BBC did there, Martin. Now, what this guy's describing, from start to finish, is a total and utter failure of those charged with protecting Trump, isn't it? You've got, what he's suggesting there is at least 4 minutes of people telling the police there's a guy with a gun, he's trying to kill the president, he's going up onto the roof, and nothing happens. Nothing.
Trying to kill the potential president, yes.
He's going to be the president.
Well, he is going.
In fact, this is funny, isn't it? Because everyone talking about Trump, most of the people, including the journalists, were calling him President Trump.
Well, according to Biden, he's the vice president already, isn't he? Yes. I mean, it's bound to raise questions. That's a very good point that he made. If they knew there was a shooter up on the roof, Trump should have been taken off the stage. That's what that would be automatic.
Pause proceedings, most pause, definitely.
That's right.
Immediately, very
why
simple.
Why didn't they do that?
They've got radios, they've got people in charge, but maybe there's
a
reason.
It's bound to raise suspicions, isn't it?
If it's going around those radios going, oh, there's a guy with a gun. Look, no, you just closed down, but they didn't close down. Why did they not close down? Anyway, the next day, roughly the same time, in fact, this is on the Sunday morning. I think it's interesting to listen to what people from the deep state had to say about it all, to see if they've got some sort of sympathy for Trump, if they think that this is a terrible thing to happen, or, you know, where are they coming from? Are they talking about, oh, yes, there's lots of terrible internet trolls that are making a great advantage? Well, that's the sort of thing Mariana Spring might say, or BBC Verify, but it doesn't actually blame the real people, does it? The people in charge at the Secret Service, it doesn't blame them at all. Let's have a little. I mean, and complaining that Trump is going to gain from this. Well, that's a sure sign of somebody that's complicit, actually, and probably did want to see Trump killed. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the former British ambassador to the US, Sir Peter Westmacott. He was on Times Radio on Sunday morning.
No stranger to the world stage, Sir Peter Westmacott, the UK's former ambassador to the US and France and Turkey. And he joins us now. Good morning, Sir Peter.
Good morning, Adam.
First of all, what's your reaction to this shooting attempted assassination of Donald Trump?
Well, it was shocking news to wake up to. I'm a couple of hours ahead of you in Turkey at the moment. And so we got a little bit of an advance warning, if you like, but it was horrific. And I think my own reaction was, oh dear, you know, Americans have seen this movie before, whether it was the attempted assassination of Ronald Reagan, whether it was the murder of President Kennedy or of Robert Kennedy. America has had gun violence in its politics much more than most Americans could possibly want. And my second reaction was a rather, I suppose, cynical political observer comment, which is to say that, fortunately, once it had become clear that Donald Trump was not seriously wounded, that this was actually almost manna from heaven, and as some of the social media people have said, the hand of God protecting their man, and it is very good for the victimhood, the martyrdom line that Donald Trump has been using during his campaign. And I think it will make Trump supporters even more determined to turn out for him. So politically, I think it may change the game a bit. I'm sorry to have to say that. It's a cynical observation. But that is the thought that one has after the horror you feel of, oh dear, is this another political assassination? As you rightly pointed out, Adam, a couple of inches in a different direction, and we could be having a very different conversation.
Yeah, quite right too. And, you know, very little actual sympathy for Trump he expressed there. He's really, talking, I suppose, there about the, Trump will gain out of it. He's blaming the gun. America's got guns and it's got a Secret Service with guns, and So this immediately flag, you know, red flags for me. You're saying, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Look, you're not blaming the gun. You blame the person with the gun, the people, other people with the guns who are supposed to stop the guy with the gun, not the gun. So this sort of thing can happen with all sorts of other weapons, as we were hearing recently, crossbows and things like that too. There's loads of different weapons you can use to kill people, folks. And so trying to sort of use this to politically leverage his anti-gun control or gun control agenda is interesting to hear him do that. To also say that Trump will gain from this and to sound it was very annoying and very irritating that Trump is going to gain. I think that a lot of the deep state did want Trump dead.
I think that's undoubtedly the case, but I don't think that's an ex-British ambassador there, and he was being very careful in his use of language. He was saying
not careful enough for my liking.
Yes, obviously you've picked up on it, but I didn't hear what you.
Full version on the show on the show page at thisweek.org.uk of that interview, where he goes on to moan about silly things that the internet trolls are saying, which is just the Mariana Spring line on this sort of thing, the BBC Verify line, and who knows, maybe even the BBC Verifier sitting there as Mariana Spring does, and setting up fake accounts to manufacture the story all on their own. But I mean, it's not interesting, really. These are just idiots that are peripheral to the main part of the story.
Yes, well, you've seen the picture, the iconic picture of Trump putting his fist in the air with an American flag behind him, Secret Service people holding him. That has gone viral, absolutely viral. And, you know,
it's going to help him, isn't it?
It's definitely going to help.
Okay. Well, anyway, the Republican National Convention is the week after. So I suppose the timing's interesting, isn't it? The timing of the assassination attempt is just before he's going to be inaugurated as nominated to be the presidential candidate. And so it's when all of those attempts to stop that happening have kind of come to an end. This is the timing of the assassination attempt.
Yes, but is it?
He's saying to himself, this shooter, I would seem to me, that, well, we've tried everything, we can't stop him, so we're going to have to blow his head off.
Yes, but of course the real suspicion is that he didn't act on his own, or that people knew what was going to happen, and that they let the guard down deliberately. I'm more inclined to that sort of view than I am that it's just an accident.
May well be, yeah. Anyway, it certainly doesn't seem to be some sort of without your shooter guy, and without the Secret Service backing off and making the window of opportunity for him, these sorts of things can't happen.
It may well be that they knew what he was going to do. Yeah. That's the sort of thing that investigation.
Well, you and I think alike on this, Martin, for a change. Anyway, Trump speaking on the assassinate attempt at the rally for the first time. And let's have a listen. This is about 10 minutes in all. But here is Donald Trump pouring out his heart, really, to those when he says halfway through this, he says, I shouldn't be here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. Wow. And thank you, Dana. Thank you, Kid Rock, sometimes referred to as Bob. And thank you, Lee, right from the beginning. Thank you very much. What a talent. What a beautiful, beautiful song. Thank you. Friends, delegates, and fellow citizens, I stand before you this evening with a message of confidence, strength, and hope. 4 months from now, we will have an incredible victory, and we will begin the four greatest years in the history of our country. Together, we will launch a new era of safety, prosperity, and freedom for citizens of every race, religion, color, and creed. The discord and division in our society must be healed. We must heal it quickly. As Americans, we are bound together by a single fate and a shared destiny. We rise together or we fall apart. I am running to be president for all of America, not half of America. Because there is no victory in winning for half of America. So tonight, with faith and devotion, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And we will do it right. Gonna do it right. Let me begin this evening by expressing my gratitude to the American people for your outpouring of love and support following the assassination attempt at my rally on Saturday. As you already know, the assassin's bullet came within a quarter of an inch of taking my life. So many people have asked me, what happened? Tell us what happened, please. And therefore, I will tell you exactly what happened. And you'll never hear it from me a second time because it's actually too painful to tell. It was a warm, beautiful day in the early evening in Butler Township in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Music was loudly playing, and the campaign was doing really well. I went to the stage, and the crowd was cheering wildly. Everybody was happy. I began speaking very strongly, powerfully, and happily, because I was discussing the great job my administration did on immigration at the southern border. We were very proud of it. Behind me and to the right was a large screen that was displaying a chart of border crossings under my leadership. The numbers were absolutely amazing. In order to see the chart, I started to, like this, turn to my right and was ready to begin a little bit further turn, which I'm very lucky I didn't do, when I heard a loud whizzing sound and felt something hit me really, really hard on my right ear. I said to myself, wow, what was that? It can only be a bullet. And moved my right hand to my ear, brought it down. My hand was covered with blood, just absolutely blood all over the place. I immediately knew it was very serious, that we were under attack, and in one movement proceeded to drop to the ground. Bullets were continuing to fly as very brave Secret Service agents rushed to the stage, and they really did. They rushed to the stage. These are great people at great risk, I will tell you, and pounced on top of me so that I would be protected. There was blood pouring everywhere, and yet, in a certain way, I felt very safe because I had God on my side. I felt that. The amazing thing is that prior to the shot, if I had not moved my head at that very last instant, the assassin's bullet would have perfectly hit its mark, and I would not be here tonight. We would not be together. The most incredible aspect of what took place on that terrible evening in the fading sun was actually seen later. In almost all cases, as you probably know, and when even a single bullet is fired, just a single bullet, and we had many bullets that were being fired, crowds run for the exits or stampede, but not in this case. It's very unusual. This massive crowd of tens of thousands of people stood by and didn't move an inch. In fact, many of them bravely but automatically stood up looking for where the sniper would be. They knew immediately it was a sniper. And then began pointing at him. You can see that if you look at the group behind me. That was just a small group compared to what was in front. Nobody ran, and by not stampeding, many lives were saved. But that isn't the reason that they didn't move. The reason is that they knew I was in very serious trouble. They saw it. They saw me go down. They saw the blood and thought, actually, most did, that I was dead. They knew it was a shot to the head. They saw the blood. And there's an interesting statistic. The ears are the bloodiest part. If something happens with the ears, they bleed more than any other part of the body. For whatever reason, the doctors told me that. I said, why is there so much blood? He said, it's the ears. They bleed more. So we learned something, but they just... this beautiful crowd, they didn't want to leave me. They knew I was in trouble. They didn't want to leave me. And you can see that love written all over their faces. They're incredible people. They're incredible people. Bullets were flying over us, yet I felt serene. But now the Secret Service agents were putting themselves in peril. They were in very dangerous territory. Bullets were flying right over them, missing them by a very small amount of inches. And then it all stopped. Our Secret Service sniper, from a much greater distance and with only one bullet used, took the assassin's life, took him out. I'm not supposed to be here tonight. Not supposed to be here. No. Thank you. But I'm not. And I'll tell you, I stand before you in this arena only by the grace of Almighty God. In watching the reports over the last few days, many people say it was a providential moment. Probably was. When I rose, surrounded by Secret Service, the crowd was confused because they thought I was dead, and there was great, great sorrow. I could see that on their faces as I looked out. They didn't know I was looking out. They thought it was over. But I could see it. I wanted to do something to let them know I was okay. I raised my right arm, looked at the thousands and thousands of people that were breathlessly waiting, and started shouting, fight, fight, fight. Thank you. Once my clenched fist went up and it was high into the air, you've all seen that, the crowd realized I was okay and roared with pride for our country like no crowd I have ever heard before. Never heard anything like it.
So that's Donald Trump at the Republican convention this week, just with his, he's quite clearly, he actually does a rather good job of taking people through it. As he explains, I don't really like to do this, but I'm going to do it once. I'm not going to do it again. So no one comes up and asks me about it again. Here we go. But it's in a way, it's a miracle the guy's alive, isn't it?
It is, but of course he's going on about how the Secret Service rescued him. The Secret Service should have taken him off the platform as soon as they realised there was a shooter. I think, of course, he's not mentioning.
So there's two. Well, he's got to sort this out with the Secret. In fact, actually, it's Biden that's in charge of the Secret Services. So it's a bit awkward for him to sort of take them on. Anyway, he wants them to protect him if and when he becomes president. There's a big difference between the individual snipers or Secret Service gunmen who are on the ground there to protect him and whoever's in charge on the end of the radio.
Well, that's right. I mean, he obviously didn't pick up on that because he's trying to build alliances with the deep state. Like, they're not trying to kill me. They're on my side, actually. But of course,
these individuals that surrounded him, obviously, that's quite a brave thing to do. Someone's shooting at you.
Yes.
And he wants to just pay tribute to them as individuals.
Okay. But nevertheless,
they're not just Secret Service people, they're human beings.
The question still has to be asked. Why was he allowed to carry on with the rally when we know there is a guy with a gun up on a
hill? Well, answer your own question then.
Well, because somebody wanted that gunman to have a good shot at him. I mean, that's the obvious conclusion to draw, even though he's not drawn it. We'll have to see what goes on, what happens next. It's going to be a very febrile election campaign.
Do you think that's it then? Do you think there'll be any more assassination attempts on Donald Trump?
I think we can imagine that there might be. And there might be, all sorts of things. U.S. politics is an extremely dirty game. Extremely dirty. Lots of people are assassinated. In fact, there's a whole list of people that have been assassinated.
UK politics isn't?
It's not quite as gun-happy.
A bit more underhand, yes. The potential assassination of people like John Smith.
That's right. In the U.S., there's a whole list of people who clearly have been assassinated by the deep state. A massive long list. In the UK, there's similar suspicions, but of course there's a great the sort of management of perceptions in Britain is that sort of thing could never possibly happen here, which is clearly not the case. In the US, everybody thinks it can happen, but they don't realise how prevalent it actually is.
In the UK, we get things like the Dr. David Kelly keeling over.
That's right.
In 2003.
Yeah. Who committed suicide, obviously.
Only
Tony.
He didn't commit suicide, as we now know.
No, don't say things like that.
So this is the way it seems to me. We've got it's accidents can happen.
Well, that's right. And of course, the purpose
UK is accidents can happen.
Well, that's right. But it's the same. It's not the UK and the US have got are partners in crime in the world scene. But I mean, this sort of thing does happen quite a lot around the world. Sadat was assassinated. Both Margaret Thatcher and John Major were nearly assassinated by the Provisional Army.
There was an attempt to assassinate.
Yes, Fico was shot the other day.
And a successful assassination of the Iranian president
if it was an assassination.
So this assassination business. A growth industry. Who's managing it?
I mean, we know who killed Soleimani. It was Trump who signed that off for the Israelis. And of course, it didn't just kill Soleimani. It killed a group of people from
I just mentioned the Iranian president who died a few weeks ago in a helicopter.
Well, what I would suggest to you is if I was Donald Trump and I had a direct line to the Almighty, as you think he has, what do you think the Almighty thinks about your assassination of Soleimani, which nearly caused World War III? Are you justified?
Is that the deep state or Trump behind that?
Trump signed it off and boasted about it. Okay? So he put his name on it. And it could have led to World War III. And he was responsible for he was the guy in charge on the day.
There's quite a lot these days that could lead to
World
War III.
Well, in other words, if we're going to have a situation...
If Trump does become president, it looks very, very likely. Yeah. Does it make World War III less or more likely?
I think it's likely either way because of the attitude towards Palestine. What Trump may try and do is... row back on the Ukraine.
Surely the Russian business is far more serious, isn't it? The Russians are a superpower, but Palestine isn't.
No, but the Israelis got nuclear weapons, and therefore nuclear war could easily happen. I think that Trump is talking the talk of trying to negotiate in Ukraine. The West has forgotten that the Russians aren't prepared to negotiate.
You're not going to have World War III with the Palestinian Hamas and the Houthis, are you? It's going to, if it happens, sure. Russia is far more dangerous.
No, no, please don't forget, Lebanon is the key to this. Hezbollah in Lebanon. And don't forget, the Russian aerospace forces and military police are already active in Syria.
Hezbollah don't have nukes, so far as we know.
Who doesn't have nukes?
Hezbollah.
No, but the Russians do, and they are in Syria. Okay, and they can fire their nukes from anywhere. They can fire their hypersonic missile. If there's a fight in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Russians will fire their hypersonic missiles from Siberia, and they will sink the USS
Eisenhower. But you are aware, aren't you, that the Vice President J.D. Vance and Trump are both talking about backing away from the European wars, backing away from
they're gung-ho for a war with China, and they're gung-ho for a war. They said to the Israelis, finish the job. Yeah, they are absolutely. Miriam Adelson has promised Trump $100 million for his campaign if he will allow the Israelis to annex the West Bank.
So has he got the money? Did he agree to that or not?
I think he has, yes. Well, so there we are. But the first thing he's going to do is escalate the war in the Middle East, which will lead directly to
one of the things that worries me, of course, about all this God stuff that he's talking about there is whether he's a Christian Zionist and whether he just believes that God wants Israel to kill all the Palestinians.
I think he certainly is. I don't know whether Trump's personal beliefs, but any listeners
have got good info on this. Please share it on my Telegram channel.
Mike Pompeo was definitely a Christian Zionist. They want the end of the world because he's going to bring the rapture.
Interesting to dig that out. Anyway, this guy JD Vance, who's going to be if Trump is assassinated, there's another attempt which is more successful this time. Then the guy who's in charge is going to be this guy JD Vance, who he announced this week as his vice presidential running mate, who's an interesting fellow. He had this thing called Mithril Capital. He went to the Bilderberg conference back in 2017, which of course is where everybody has to go who's going to be in charge in the whole of all the NATO countries. And so it was interesting to see that his little face popped up there. Although there is some, I think one of our friends had said that his wife was having a child, so he didn't actually go. His name is still on the list of attendees at Bilderberg 2017. But I suppose the point is, who is this guy? And so let's have a listen now to him talking about Iran, because he's extremely anti-Iran. And maybe that's one of the reasons that Trump has picked him, just simply because that represents the deep state. Now, it looks to me as if Trump is pushed out of the way by whatever means, whether he is sent to jail, which seems to have failed, or whether he's assassinated, this guy will be in charge.
A lot of people recognize that we need to do something with Iran, but not these weak little bombing runs. If you're going to punch the Iranians, you punch them hard, and that's what he did when he took out Soleimani. By the way, that action, people said that it would lead to broader war. It actually brought peace. It actually checked the Iranians and slowed them down a little bit. But let me just say something about this Iran issue, because maybe the most important diplomatic breakthrough of the Trump administration was the Abraham Accords. If you want to check Iran, the way to do it is to, one, withdraw their oil money, which of course Joe Biden's been bad about, but you've also got to enable the Israelis and the Sunni Arab states to work together and actually provide a counterbalance to Iran. Joe Biden has done nothing. You have the infrastructure there, sitting there, to weaken Iran, to strengthen our ally Israel. Joe Biden's done nothing with it. Donald Trump will reinvigorate it.
So that's that is J.D. Vance there with the music in the background, because this is recorded in the Republican convention where they've got music constantly blaring out all the time, maybe so that it covers up the conversation so the listening devices can't hear what people are saying. So, but anyway, you know, he's a bit of a dodgy one, this guy, isn't he? He's saying, by killing Soleimani, that brought peace.
Yeah, I mean, and these are the people who are going to be taking over. And they're going to blunder straight into this at the very beginning. And, of course, Starmer is going to go, and he's going to join in. And we're going to be at war with Lebanon as well. And, of course, Nasrallah, who's head of Hezbollah, said, if the British join in, we are going to attack your bases at Akrotiri. The Russians have already told us, if your Storm Shadow missiles fired into Russia, we're going to attack your bases in Britain. So before the end of the year, we could have Russian and Iranian and Hezbollah and Yemeni missiles raining down on our military forces around the world.
Maybe George Galloway was right, that with the Starmer government, we are going to be at war.
Well, that's right. It's not because of Starmer. Starmer's a factotum. It's because the deep state in the West wants war with all of these people, and they're going to get their wish. It's just extraordinary to me that they think they're going to win, because they're not going to win. Soleimani's death actually strengthened the Iranians enormously. Their attack on Israel after the attack on their embassy in Damascus was devastating in that it showed that the Israelis have got no defence against the hypersonic missiles which the Axis of Resistance and the Russians and China
are
using.
NATO hasn't got anything like that. The Houthis have just claimed a deadly drone strike on Tel Aviv. So this is the Yemenis. So they're saying, well, look, you know, we're going to start hitting the Israelis. And we'll stop as soon as they stop killing people in Gaza.
That's right. And they're not going to stop killing people in Gaza, so we're all on for this. And of course, it will start quickly.
Well,
and
surely
with a bang.
Netanyahu could be ejected. He's not necessarily bulletproof. Well, sorry,
no, he's not.
That's not the right word. He's not necessarily going to be continue as the prime minister.
No, but even if he's removed, you will see that all major Israeli politicians are saying the same things. They're basically in a bloodthirsty mood. They are, you know, they've got blood in their eyes, and you know, this is very dangerous. I mean, the whole world is full of people who are now screaming for war. And that's exactly what happened in 1914. Everybody was screaming for war, and then they got what they were all screaming for.
Well, yeah, but it does look as if, like I say, Trump is not interested in Ukraine, really.
No.
Well, that's what they're saying, both these two, is that they're interested in back. They're interested in the Middle East, sure, yeah.
Yeah.
This is their big thing.
Right.
But Ukraine is a sideshow. And actually, surely that could be very good for Europe, for all Europeans, if we get these two Republicans in charge. You know, Trump before has threatened to pull the U.S. out of NATO, Martin.
Yes, I know, but I mean, whether we need to disband NATO. NATO is a
question. Address my question. There's a political move within the Republican Party with Trump and Vance to basically pull away from all this support for Zelensky. And actually, as that's all happening in London, he's getting even more support from Starmer for some
reason. That's right. So the European Union and Britain leadership, apart from, you know, Fico and Orban, are pushing for. I mean, it's absolutely insane.
What will happen if the Americans do back away from supporting the Ukrainians?
Will
the Europeans have the stomach to take the Russians on their own?
This is the sort of thing that we'll see what the leadership qualities of Sakir are. He will probably say, no, we will take it over. The Americans have reneged on us, but we will support Zelensky. Zelensky's been killed. Oh, Zelensky isn't even the president, of course, because he's supposed to stand for election in May, and he didn't. And
will the Europeans take on the Russians on their own without the Americans egging them on?
No, they're talking about doing it, but they can't. Nobody can. Nobody is going to beat the Russian army on its own doorstep. If you try to send troops across from the US, they'd put them on the ships, and then Russian submarines would sink them before they got into the mid-Atlantic. The Russians can fire their missiles anywhere on the planet. They can fire under Antarctica and hit America under Antarctica within less than half an hour. The West simply does not have that kind of weaponry. They've lost air superiority. If it comes to a fight, we're most likely, through accident, to blow ourselves up. The nuclear war thing is not really a joke. We're at 1.5 minutes to midnight, as we were saying on this show last week. This is the closest we've been to nuclear war ever. But everybody's so obsessed with all the other things that their minds are full of that they haven't focused on.
The Europeans won't take on Russia.
Well, they will talk about taking on Russia, but they won't. If the Poles try and come into Ukraine, there will be attacks on their. As they put troops into the Ukraine, they're already being killed. And if they use bases to fly these F-16s from Romania and Poland, the Russians will attack those bases in Romania and Poland. Yeah. Then they'll say, we're under attack, we want NATO to protect. NATO hasn't got an army like the Russians have got. They simply haven't got one. Mm. It's just not there.
They've got nukes, Martin.
Yes, but then that's just annihilation of everything. It's not really much use for a conventional battle,
well,
is it?
It doesn't matter. Sometimes people just...
This
seems to be the game, it seems to me.
Can we just go to
Gaza now? Because the BBC don't have anyone in Gaza, but we do. That's the lovely Wafa Aludaini, who I said to her, which charity would you like me to put a link up to? She said, I don't want any money. Don't give me... I'm not interested in that at all. So here's her report this week. She's able to do reports from time to time, she tells me, when she's got a minute, which is looking into the Gaza situation with food and water and also with health. What she's talking about here is basically chemical and biological warfare against the Gazan people.
Hi, this is Wafa Aludaini, Palestinian journalist, reporting to you from the besieged Gaza Strip. About the latest update on the 282 days of Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip. The months of continuous bombing and Israel's fuel blockade have destroyed Gaza's outdated waste collection system due to panning of access to Gaza's three official landfills. After human rights groups warned that the chemical soup of matter and heavy metals could contaminate water supplies and farmland, and eventually toxic substances penetrate the food chain and find their way back to humans. Now, according to the Ministry of Health, diseases are spreading in Gaza amid water and sewage crisis, and recently they discovered a virus in the water that causes a polio disease. The entire population of the Gaza Strip are still living in deep humanitarian crisis amid lack of all essentials of life, including food, water, fuel, and medicine. During the past few days, the Israeli occupation warplanes hit several UNRWA and schools and makeshift tent zones, massacring more than 500 displaced Palestinians, mostly women and children. These areas are designated as safe zones by the Israeli army, yet they targeted them. More people died due to malnutrition, which resulted from the lack of food and clean water and medicine, as Israel still blocks the crossings and bans goods, fuel from entering the tiny enclave. At least 70 Palestinian detainees have been released recently from the Israeli prisons. They looked in a very terrible condition due to severe torture they endured and lack of food. One of the detainees is still in critical condition in the intensive care in Al-Aqsa Hospital, who we met earlier today. This is Wafaa Lodaini, Palestinian journalist, reporting to you from the besieged Gaza Strip.
Exclusively for this programme, Martin.
Yeah, and of course the buzzing in the background from when we recorded her last time, that is the drones overhead, is what you were saying. Well, it's a shocking situation, isn't it? I believe that she was saying there that they found polio virus in the water supply. That may be because, you know, the conditions have just deteriorated so badly that the virus is taking root. Or it may be that it's been deliberately put in there by the Israelis. We can't be sure either way, can we? But it's still an absolutely disgraceful situation.
Netanyahu's blocked the order from the IDF to actually build a field hospital for Gaza children. He says, no, we're not having that. And there's been a letter, at least in the United States, 230 congressional staffers signed a letter to protest Netanyahu's speech, which he's given in the US. What's happening?
Well, he's coming to the US, is he not? He's sort of invited himself, and he's going to be given a red carpet treatment. They're all going to be waving Israeli flags, and he's going to be saying, we're all going to war with Iran, and they're all going, yeah, 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 and no doubt Trump and Vance will be cheering him on. That's where we're at, folks.
So, the Democratic Party platform has backed Biden's approach to Gaza, which doesn't sound very good, does it? Biden, just briefly on him this week. He's history. Who's going to be in charge? I mean, the guy is just, obviously, you know, he's got COVID now. We've known and we've been discussing for years, actually, on this program, that the guy's totally incompetent. He can't stand. I feel it's a little bit like our general election here with Sunak, not really wanting to win. I mean, you get the idea that the Democratic Party don't really want to win if they even consider putting him as their, presidential candidate.
Well, as you know, they're having a big row about it at the minute. Because he is such an established figure, uh-huh, after many, many, many years, that they feel as if they're stuck with him. Others want to get rid of him, but it's not clear if they got rid of him and replaced him with somebody else, that it would be Trump. It's not
pernicious,
clear.
Proper gender aspect to this is all the time you've got an idiot like Biden in charge. That's what everyone is talking about. They're not talking about the policies. They're not talking about World War III.
No, there's a very good article by Katie Johnson this week, who's based in Australia, and she's got these Americans arguing about what should be happening in American politics, and the tax on Trump, you know, Biden, this, that, and the other, and they walked past the hospital, which was on fire, and they saw the baby screaming, and they carried on talking about this and this, because in actual fact, the world is on fire, and we're spending all this time talking about Trump. You know, I mean, we have to talk about Trump, but it's still an imposition when we've got all of these real people, realer than Trump, who's only a TV personality at the end of the day, really being killed in front, you know, in real time. I mean, the world is becoming coming right to the edge.
There are some wonderful things going on, though, which hardly get reported in this part of the world. On Thursday, the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, said she noted comments from former President Donald Trump and his running mate about ending the war in Ukraine. But she said Moscow needed to be realistic about the prospect. We saw the statements. Trump said he would resolve the conflict within 24 hours. And Vance said that China is a much bigger problem for the US than Russia. And it's necessary to separate pre-election rhetoric from statements by government officials vested with the appropriate powers. When we talk about whether it's possible to resolve the conflict, let's be realistic. She pointed out during the previous Trump administration, the president and some of his advisers made statements about bringing peace to the Middle East. They prepared for the deal of the century for quite a long time, but it did not end in anything. And under Biden, on the contrary, a colossal historic tragedy has happened. Putin also noted Trump's comments about ending the war in Ukraine and said he took them seriously, but said he's not familiar with any concrete proposals put forward by the former president. So although there's a lot of talk about this, who knows whether the people, even if they do vote for peace in Ukraine with Trump, that they're even going to get it.
Well, that's right. Trump said he was going to withdraw the US forces from Syria, but basically the US military just said nah, and they didn't do it. And
well,
didn't do anything about
saying,
it.
Actually, Vance wants the US to wind down its support for Ukraine only so it could focus more on building up the Asia Pacific and arming Taiwan.
Well, don't forget the Russians are best friends, besties with the Chinese, so they're not necessarily going to be cheering that on. Yeah, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization had a meeting this week in Kazakhstan, I think. Everybody is preparing now for World War III. Everybody's
anyway,
prepared.
We're going to wind up now. I'd love to play you I think was brilliant, one of these Judging Freedom special reports with former CIA analyst Larry Johnson and Ray McGovern talking about the Trump assassination attempt. So I'll put the full version of that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. I've got a sort of 10-minute clip of it, which is brilliant, but we haven't really got time for that. But I will finish this week with a lady called Amy Fallon. I met last week. She's an Australian journalist living in London. She's been working on the Julian Assange campaign. She had some extraordinary tales to tell me when I spoke to her earlier this week about Julian Assange's involvement and Andrew Feinstein's involvement and Craig Murray's involvement and Roger Waters' involvement in the South Africans bringing the case for genocide against Israel at the International Court of Justice.
Roger Waters is quite a controversial unquote figure. But the talk on Palestine, you know, it was so fascinating, and it was brilliant, and I learned a lot from it. He said to us that, you know, like Craig and like many of you, I wake up every morning on the verge of tears. He thinks, what can I do today to be part of this movement to stop the genocide of my brothers and sisters in Gaza? But he said that he hoped the tide may be turning and that you know, that things will change. And Roger Waters was also campaigning for a number of, non-Labor people stand him as non-Labor MPs. Also Andrew Feinstein in Holborn, who stood against Keir Starmer. What was amazing was that Craig, during this talk about Palestine, also told the story of how he initiated the case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And that was super fascinating because he told us how he went to the US and met Sam Husseini at an Assange event in Washington. Sam Husseini is, I think he's a Palestinian, but he's a journalist and activist. But anyway, Sam Husseini said, why is no one activating the Genocide Convention? And Craig thought about it. And, of course, he had worked as a diplomat in a UK diplomat in Uzbekistan before he blew the whistle on terrible human rights abuses there. So he understood how the Genocide Convention works. So he wrote a couple of articles and published them on his blog. And then a group of activists started lobbying around the world to, you know, try and get the convention brought into play. But Julian Assange actually played a part from behind bars. And also Roger, you know, because he's famous, spoke to presidents in South America. And then somehow Julian and Stella got their Scott Craig's articles in front of Andrew Feinstein, who is a former ANC, South African ANC MP, and that's how, and then, you know, it got the attention of the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, and that's how South Africa ended up taking it to court. So, I mean, yeah, an absolutely amazing story of what can be achieved when people are working together. I mean, I was just absolutely fascinated when I heard that story.
I mean, yeah, it is incredible, isn't it? And of course, the ANC government now being deposed.
I mean, yeah, God, yeah. I mean, just think of it now. Yeah, at the time, I mean, just when I heard that, you know, like Julian Assange had been involved and that, you know, people were working together, I just thought, oh my God, yeah. And Craig actually said to us, you know, at the time he wasn't actually able to say anything about Julian's involvement.
Good. Well, it's the ANC that have been gotten rid of, you know. So maybe there's been a bit of interference. Who knows? There's lots of. We've got a whole theme on this week's program about election interference, looking at you know, the disappearing postal votes in Scotland, the ID cards that people don't have but the poor people are supposed to have if they want to vote, voter suppression, leaflets not being delivered by the post office, interference and by the press in not listing candidates, just disappearing them. So a lot of, I mean, that's why I mentioned this business of South Africa and the possibility that, you know, there's a wider agenda in moving the politics there because of the South African, very successful so far, actually, South African actions at the International Court of Justice. But anyway, look, we've got Stella, we've got Julian, we've got the kids now all together. What do you think's next? What do you think's next for him?
I think we all of us who have been following this and supporting it, I think we're so happy that he's been released and that they're all back together for him, for Stella, because my God, she's an amazing woman in her own right, and you know, the family, for John, his father, and Gabrielle, his brother. So I just hope that they can all have a break and have some peace now. I think Julian Assange will be forgiven if, you know, he just went and disappeared for the rest of his life.
So that's Amy Fallon there. Fantastic. She's got her own, I'll put a link up to her website. She's been doing human rights work in Africa. Been a big stalwart for the Assange campaign. But she's saying now, you know, rather than, Martin, one of the things, rather than free Assange, it's now pardon Assange. People are just swapping over their hashtags. Obviously, it's not quite such a big movement, but there's still a lot of the hardcore people are saying, well, we're not going away.
Well, I think he's got a strong case for millions of dollars of compensation from the US government, hasn't he?
And the British.
And the British government. Absolutely. So it's
Do you think Keir Starmer, the human rights lawyer, will fight his case in the?
No, I don't.
Ah,
but there you are.
Well, so the British system is, well, a little bit corrupted. Oh well. Final item tonight. I did say that was final, but it isn't, because we've got Patrizia's ode this week, which is all about the Trump assassination. It's called Lost Boy. Thank you, Patrizia. Little boy lost, no friends to be found, bullied at school, no clubs or fame found. Adults chit-chat, perchance, listened in, shoot Donald Trump. This act, hoped, would win. Alone in his room, grooming perhaps, fortune and fame, at heels felt it snap. No rhyme to the reason this boy lost his mind. On roof that was sloped, he left life behind. One moment, young man, with all life ahead, next moment took aim. Now he is dead. Tall tales of a lad whose life now is gone, no truth e'er be found in saddest swan song, as tales of the whys and wherefores will run. MSM full of speculation, now rife, a young man lies dead, a waste of a life. Stories made bold, piled high on the pyre, no sense ever comes from bullets once fired. A circus surrounds us, partake if you will, step back and take breath, a patsy, space filled. Thanks very much, Patricia. Though he's not necessarily a patsy, but anyway, the point is, I suppose, Martin, the 20-year-old, when you're at that age, and I'm sure you were like this, like I was, when you're 20 years old, you're not afraid of dying, are you, in a weird way? You're that's why I think they recruit a lot of these youngsters into the army, because they think that they can do anything.
Well, they tend to believe that they're immortal, don't they? Yes, well, I mean, he may be a patsy. We don't know. That's all I'll say.
So that somebody else did it, really, not him? No.
I'm just saying that
The patsy is surely when someone else is being framed for something they didn't do.
But I mean, the real criminals may be inside the structure.
Well, they are, too, well, yes. Yeah. MK Ultra, maybe? Some sort of
yes,
mind
all of these things are possibilities, aren't they?
Maybe it's just a sort of grooming exercise. Who knows? Anyway, I hope that we've covered most aspects of this. And let's thank God that Trump managed to survive all this. You know, you don't have to vote for the guy. And I don't support Trump. I mean, he's just another gangster like all the rest. But at least he's not a Bilderberger. He's not one of these inside the system, the Fourth Reich. He's on the periphery of all that. It may be that they can manipulate him. But I think we have to be rather pleased that the guy's managed to survive it. And maybe it will make him think, when he becomes president, that seems inevitable, about launching wars which will kill other people and make more and more bullets fly into the future. Anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks very much to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, a deputy leader of the Workers' Party, also Andy Hudd, and of course to Eric Simon, speaking to us from France, also sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send us interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, and you'll find all the podcasts, full-length interviews, quite a few this week, plus that one we didn't even play a part of with the ex-CIA people talking about the Trump assassination. Fascinating, that is. Story links, comment page, and our email addresses. And on the app, you get it all very, very easy. It all works rather nicely. As soon as I upload them later tonight, pop, 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 it pops up on the app. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter if you like, by emailing me. And if you can afford it, please donate or even set up a small monthly subscription at thisweekoneword.org.uk, a place to go for all of that stuff. Please do listen again next week if you can. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream. And on Sunday breakfast at CamberleysRadioQUK.com. That is, the stream is talkradio.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the Eastone Studios in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream at RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and RadioSoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and live on Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast, even on AM or FM, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend away from the Empire of Lies. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. Don't get sucked in to the Zero Trust agenda, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
The desert wind. Washington bullets again. the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium. Verdad. Oh, those Washington bullets again. And in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color, is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color, double a new spray of lead. Moscow bullets missed. Ask him what he thinks of voting communist. Ask the Dalai Lama in the hills of Tibet. How many monks did the Chinese get in a war-torn swamp? Stop any mercenary and check the British bullets in his armory.
all the fruitless soldiers. Oh, I see the light and the heat. Oh, I wanna be that complete. I wanna touch the light, the heat I see in your eyes.
The heat.